You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, guns and butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
That card, which was a prayer list that that Hoover had, was carried by Tolson and given to the Dixie Mafia leader, whom he and Hoover obviously had worked over many years, and in particular worked on this assassination. It had the names of John Kennedy on it. It was a prayer list, and it had the names of John Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., and Robert Kennedy. And they were three people whose deaths were being prayed for.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today's show, The Plot to Kill King, an interview with Dr. William Pepper, 39 years into the investigation. William Pepper is an attorney, an author, and a poet. He is the author of three books on the assassination of Martin Luther King, Orders to Kill, An Act of State, and his third and latest book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., which includes shocking new revelations. Today we discuss Dr. King's legacy and all that was lost with his assassination, the war in Vietnam, the control of major media, and disturbing revelations by new witnesses about the conspiracy to end Dr. King's life. Dr. William Pepper, welcome.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's good to be with you.
You have just published your third and final book on Dr. King, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King. Your book is beautifully written. You've been able to convey the magnitude of the tragedy on many different levels. You write in your introduction that the evidence presented will once and for all uncover the crucial role of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, his deputy Clyde Tolson, the ultimate assassins, the medical officials at St. Joseph's Hospital, and finally, the identification of the shooter, including my interview with the primary assassin of Martin Luther King Jr. You also write that far from being elated that the truth is now with us face to face, I feel consumed by a sadness that will be a lifelong emotional presence. Could you talk about that sadness and all that was lost with the murder of Dr. King?
Yes, it's a twofold reaction. What was lost, of course, primarily was the humane and progressive leadership and growth in that leadership of Martin Luther King that went with him to the grave, and that denied the Republic of the wisdom and insights and strong compulsion for humanity and the suffering of the wretched of the earth. When Martin King was taken from us, that was also denied to us and to future generations. And I think we see so much of that loss today, not just in the United States, but throughout the world, in the absence of that kind of leadership. So at one level, the loss itself has to render one very sad and depressed that this could happen. The historical relevance of Martin King's death has sort of compelled me to look back in history and be confronted with an awareness of the use of political assassinations throughout history, which I think we often overlook when we focus on a particular context of an assassination. We have not really grasped the fact that throughout history, and I'm going back to the dawn of human society and the development of civilization, we've not grasped the fact that often major historical events and times have been changed through the use of political assassination by ruling forces in a society. And I've been confronted with that, and that aspect of the human condition is sadness upon sadness because of the immediate loss of in our lifetime of Martin King. The second level of sadness has to do with just the whole dynamics of this particular assassination and how it was carried out and who was involved in it, and the whole structure, of values that existed at the time and still exists today in the utilization of violence, not just by public figures who have betrayed their trust, but by professionals. And I mean trained medical professionals who had a sworn separate set of oaths in terms of the obligation to human life and well-being. So it's a twofold reservoir of sadness, if you will.
Included in the appendices of The Plot to Kill King is your article, The Children of Vietnam, published by Ramparts magazine, that cataloged the devastating effects of napalm and white phosphorus bombing that had been unleashed on the young and old in Vietnam. Since your involvement with Dr. King came about because of this article, could you talk about how the war affected Dr. King and yourself? How long were you in Vietnam as a reporter?
I was in Vietnam in the spring of 1966. My visit was cut short to 6 weeks because of an injury suffered in a plane a mishap and forced landing that caused a injury to my back, from which I suffer, I must say, even today. But during that period of time that I was there, I spent it mostly out in the country, away from Saigon and the Pentagon briefings, the Arvin briefings, as they were. And so I was in shelters and camps and hospitals and schools and places where the people lived. And so in the villages, and I had the opportunity to photograph and to chronicle the devastation of heavy armaments and really criminal assaults on an ancient and civilian people. Those were, of course, the major victims. Being confronted with those war crimes, and that's what they were, being confronted with that type of war criminality, really for the first time, although one has, in the civil rights movement and elsewhere, had come across activity that was heinous and racist and damaging, destructive. But nothing like that in terms of the degree of terror and human damage that I saw. Having been confronted with that for the first time, and then not developing any photographs or writing anything until I returned to the U.S., I had to then relive it, if you will, when I went through the preparation of that Ramparts piece. It moved Dr. King enormously. He had no idea the degree of horror that we were, as the most powerful nation on earth, were visiting upon this ancient civilization, and its people. He wept at one point when he went through some of my files and saw some of the brutality, a good portion of which was also reported in the article, because most of the civilians were either children or very old people, and children being the dominant victims. To the extent that we eventually formed a committee of responsibility and brought over to the United States about 100 war-injured children for recuperative and therapeutic treatment here in the States, across the country, and then, of course, returning them to Vietnam after all that could be done for them was completed. Martin King was devastated by this. And as a result, we met for the first time in very early 1967, and the piece came out in January of 67. We met, I guess it was February or so in 67. He then decided to go forward and frontally oppose the war, which he did on April 4th, as you know, April 4th, 1967, a year to the day, to his death, with his speech at Riverside Church. And he was determined to use whatever means he could to oppose that war, and asked me to work with him and to do what I could do in terms of the formation of the National Conference for New Politics and its attempts to do a political opposition to the Johnson administration. And I agreed to be its executive director for that purpose.
Now, the consolidation and control of major media was already in place in the 60s, wasn't it?
It was, but it wasn't consolidated to the point that it is, if I may say so, that it is today. And you had exceptions, you had individuals, and you had opportunities to get on programs from time to time. I remember that Dr. Spock, Ben Spock, and I went on the Today Show with Barbara Walters and Hugh Downs. Now, that would be perhaps unheard of today, but we did that. I remember that Bill Atwood, and I recount this experience in the book because I think it's so significant. Bill Atwood, of course, was the editor, managing editor of Look magazine, and he wanted to publish my Ramparts piece in Look, to give it nationwide exposure and to give the war and the conduct of the war nationwide exposure. And I remember going into Bill Atwood's office at Look and him coming across the room and extending his hands and this a grin on his face saying, "You'll be pleased to know that I had a visitor last week." Or maybe not so pleased, but anyway, I had this visitor last week, and I said, "Oh, who would that be then?" And he said, "Avril Harriman flew in from Washington to see me." I said, "Oh, and what did Governor Harriman want?" And he said, "Well, he brought me greetings from the President of the United States, and he said the President had a favor to ask of me." And what was that? And he said, "Well, the favor was that I would never publish anything that Bill Pepper wrote." And he said, "Now, what do you think of that? You're not even 30 years old, and the President of the United States is worried about my publishing something that you have written." And I said, "I'm more interested in what you said to Governor Harriman." And he chuckled and said, "Well, I told him we're going to see you next week. And if we believed what you said and we were impressed with your documentation and photographs and backup, we were going to publish. Oh, and by the way, give the President my best regards." Now, that was Bill Atwood, and he was a rare person then, and of course, virtually impossible to imagine someone like him in that position today. The problem was, I'll just give you a quick ad-lib. The problem was, the next week he had Jim Garrison come up from New Orleans, And the same man who brought me in, Chandler Brossard, the associate or deputy editor, brought in Garrison. And or he might have spent about 5 hours or so with me. I think he must have spent 6-7 with Garrison. And he called Bob Kennedy that night at 1 o'clock in the morning. And he said to Bobby Kennedy, I've just had this long session with New Orleans District Attorney Garrison. He's convinced me that the CIA killed your brother. And I'm shaken with this evidence and this information. And Bob apparently said to him, we know that, but I've got to get the White House in order to reopen that whole investigation. Well, that phone call took place around 1 a.m. At 4 a.m., Bill Atwood had a heart attack. And he left Look magazine and was never to return, and except as an occasional roving editor. But he was finished. Brossard was fired. And, of course, neither my piece or that of Jim Garrison was ever published in Look. I don't mean to imply anything sinister about the heart attack. I have no evidence or information about that at all. But it was obviously a very stressful encounter that Bill Atwood had. And I did speak with his widow some years later, in the course of my work. And she said to me, Bill, please don't involve me or try to get me involved with what you're doing. Bill respected you and your work, and but I have children to raise in this country. And I've respected that wish ever since.
Wow, what a story. You do have to kind of wonder about that heart attack. My God.
Yeah, well, you wonder about a lot of things. You're not sure, you know. I mean, and also years later, when we did the television trial, I guess it was, Bryant Gumbel went on a limb that most people would not go out, and he asked me to stay for a second session on the Today Show, and that was very unusual, and he was very hostile in the first session, and the second, he seemed to take the answers on board, and was much more of a compatible interviewer. He, of course, was then given an offer I guess he couldn't refuse by CBS, left the Today Show, and eventually, of course, left CBS and has been out of mainstream news media ever since. So one doesn't really know the answers to what underlies a lot of these events and changes, but it's worrying, and it's very worrying. I know when Dexter King and I were asked to go on Larry King at one point, because the King family, of course, supported my work, and I represented them in a civil trial, which the country doesn't even know about. It has 70 witnesses, 30 days in a court of law in Memphis, Tennessee, which laid out, at that point in time in 1999, all that we knew, all the evidence we had about the assassination. And Larry apologized to me before the program started and said, I'm sorry, I've just been, I've been ordered to add a third guest to the list, and so therefore Reverend Jackson will be sitting in with us on this interview tonight. And I thought that was interesting, actually.
Oh, well, that's interesting. So was this interview broadcast?
Yes, that one, it was broadcast, and Jesse did what he could do to temper what we were learning and what we knew, and to sort of leave the door open that James Earl Ray probably did have some involvement, but even if he wasn't the shooter, and you know, it clouded some of the issues.
I'm speaking with attorney and author Dr. William Pepper. Today's show, The Plot to Kill King, an interview with Dr. William Pepper 39 years into the investigation. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What was J. Edgar Hoover and Clyde Tolson's prayer list?
Fascinating card that I include in the appendix to the book because it was given to me by the son of the Dixie Mafia leader, really, whose family carried out so much of the action activity on the ground. And in addition to a very lengthy deposition, which is included in its entirety. By the way, Bonnie, I want to make it clear that though I've excerpted from depositions that were filmed and sworn to and taken under oath, well, I've used excerpts from them to make points and to recite the history, I have included the most significant depots in their entirety, so I could not be accused of taking things out of context. I wanted readers and researchers to be able to have access to the entire depositions. That card, which was a prayer list that that Hoover had, was carried by Tolson and given to the Dixie Mafia leader, whom he and Hoover obviously had worked over many years, and in particular worked on this assassination. It had the names of John Kennedy on it. It was a prayer list, and it had the names of John Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., and Robert Kennedy. And they were three people whose deaths were being prayed for.
Did the prayer list actually say that they were praying for their deaths?
Didn't say that, but that's what I was advised was Tolson told the old man, Russell Adkins, that this was the list. This was their prayer list for the deaths of these three people who were unacceptable.
You write that, quote, the stories of several key witnesses, silent for decades, are revealed for the first time. What are a few of the stories of these key witnesses, and who are they? Let's begin with the Adkins family, starting with the father, Russell Adkins. Who was he?
Well, Russell Adkins was a well-known we call him Dixie Mafia leader. He actually had a sort of a nondescript job working for the Memphis Public Works Department, would you believe? But and that was what he did in terms of his front for getting money in. But he also operated every conceivable kind of illegal business, which involved corrupting police and getting involved in politics. Virtually no one would run for mayor without the Adkins group's serious support. They were involved in a lot of local assassinations. He had a local hitman whose family he bought a house. They all lived in the same general area, and they had a good working relationship. So we believe with Carlos Marcello, who used to come up and was present at many of the meetings, and that of course was the big mafia. Marcello ran that whole area, and the Dixie Mafia were these local guys, the local types. They're all Masons and all members of the Klan. And in fact, Russell Adkins' son, Ron Tyler Adkins, told me that he was taken to his first lynching at the age of six. They were Klansmen. They were Masons, and they had a good working relationship. Developed a good working relationship with Hoover and his FBI office, and the main contact and liaison was Clyde Tolson, who was Hoover's number two and Hoover's lover. would, of course, come regularly into Memphis and meet with the Adkins family. And Tolson was the main conduit of information and instructions for the assassination of activity against Martin King. He went on a couple of transatlantic trips with old man Adkins, where they could spend time together and they could discuss details away from any prying eyes or listening ears. So they were very close. They worked very closely together. And when Russell Adkins died in July of 67, a year before the assassination, his son Russell Jr. Ostensibly took over, but as we got into it more and more, it became pretty clear that Frank Holloman, who was formerly worked in Hoover's office in Washington and who was the director of police and fire in Memphis during that last year of King's life, that it was Frank Holloman who pretty much ran things on the ground and worked with Dixie Mafia as well as a couple of Marcello's lieutenants, particularly one Frank Liberto, who ran a warehouse operation in Memphis, but who was one of Marcello's key lieutenants in the Mafia operations in Memphis. So that was who the Adkins family was, and it was Russell Adkins, accompanied by one of our main witnesses, his son, Ron Tyler, who at the time was about 15. Adkins with Tyler carried $25,000 that Tolson brought in for the purpose to the warden of the Missouri State Penitentiary to organize the escape of James Earl Ray. They had profiled James Earl Ray as an inmate, as a con who could be used as the patsy in the killing. And once he had been profiled and chosen, then the money was sent and his escape was arranged with a meeting that took place in November, December of 1966. And James escaped on April 23rd, 1967. Poor James never knew, of course, that he was being set up to be used this way. But he was certainly very willing to take advantage of an opportunity to escape, which he did.
What did you learn from Russell Adkins' son, Ron Tyler Adkins?
A great deal about the planning for the assassination, how they set things up, the commitment to get Martin King, the involvement of Tolson, which was a major surprise to me, actually, the degree of involvement of Clyde Tolson, who would be coming in continually and meeting with the family and even traveling with the old man. So we learned a good deal. I mean, he was down on Mulberry Street, where the motel is located, on a motor scooter bike at the time of the assassination. He saw Earl Clark, who was the spotter for the shooter, in my view, come down over the wall right after the shot, run up Mulberry and get into a waiting police car to be driven away. And that was corroborated by a taxi driver who saw the same and who told it to another taxi driver. That taxi driver who actually saw it was killed that night by Russ Adkins' hitman because he saw Clark coming down. And Clark was a lieutenant in the police force. Clark was afraid that he would be recognized. So young Adkins walked us through everything that he recalled. Remember, he was only a boy at the time, and it was his job often to bring in the donuts and the coffee, and he would sit on the side, and he'd hear all things that are going on, you know. And he was the source of a great deal of information and background and identifying who the key people were who were a part of his father's group who were involved in the assassination.
Could you talk about the money that Ron Tyler Adkins witnessed Clyde Tolson bringing bags of money, didn't he, to his father to distribute?
Yeah, he brought, Ron said that money in brown paper bags was brought in by Tolson, and the father would distribute it for the purpose of getting ongoing information about King's movements and activities. There are two sources of money that were paid out apparently in those days. And one was from the local Memphis FBI office. And these were people who were regularly on payroll, who were very active and prominent in Memphis politics and Memphis public life. And then there were special funds that he described that were brought in. And I think it's important, Bonnie, to understand that everything related to these events and this type of activity of Clyde Tolson, and by the way, we have in the book a photograph of Tolson with Adkins' family. So there's, you know, we have photographic proof that this took place. But in terms of the narrative and the deposition, and it is under oath, believe you know, it's there. It's also filmed under oath. That these amount to allegations, and it's important to be sure that people understand that they're allegations. It's my opinion that this young man, now not so young, of course, had no reason to lie about these events and things that he saw. And I think he was trying to unburden himself with a lot of the story that he told. But it has to be all taken in that context of allegations.
Well, in that context of allegations, there were actual individuals' names on some of these bags of money. What were some of the names?
Yeah, he indicated that he saw names of prominent people who were providing services and information on Dr. King and the SCLC movement and their plans and strategy with respect to the sanitation workers' strike. Remember, Dr. King came into Memphis to support the sanitation workers. And after that, he was going to lead the Poor People's March in Washington. And he saw these bags with names on them. One of them was of the Reverend Billy Kiles, who was a prominent black preacher in Memphis. And according to him, was being paid regularly for information and about again the movement and the strategy and related to the sanitation workers' strike. Reverend Kiles. It was at Reverend Kiles' home that the barbecue that evening was to take place. And it was Reverend Kyle's job to get Martin King out of the motel room at 6 o'clock that evening. And in fact, the police logs of the surveillance officer, who also testified at the 1999 trial, but he confirmed his own notes, which indicated that Kyle's went to the door of the motel room, room 306. Knocked on the door. The door opened just briefly, remained open for a short while, and then was closed. And Kyles walked down the balcony, north on the balcony, and just stood there and waited. Kyles had maintained all of his professional post-assassination life that he was in the room with Dr. King for the last half hour of his life, talk, and they carried on, and so he has always said that he was there for that last half hour inside the room. When I first raised this with Abernathy, who, of course, was in the room, he said, Billy Kyle's a liar. He was never in the room. And that was the first indication I had that until we got the documentation that Kyle's was not, in fact, in the room, and he had lied all of those years. So that's the story of Reverend William Sammy Kyles. And pretty clear from what Ron Adkins said that he was being paid regularly for information. Yeah. So that's one example of someone who whose name was allegedly on the paper bag that Ron Tyler Adkins saw.
What do you make of Adkins's son's revelations or claims that Reverend Jesse Jackson's name was on one of these bags of money?
Well, I want to say again that this is an allegation. It is an allegation made under oath, but it nevertheless is an allegation by an individual who had a fair amount to say about Reverend Jackson, and that to me is obviously disturbing and worrying. I can't assert anything as being factual about what he has said because I didn't see it. And I am just put forward what this man has told me under oath that he did see. I don't perceive that he would have any reason to engage in fabrication, but I think I can only state exactly what he said without labeling it as factual or truthful, but just as an allegation that has been made. And he did say, yes, he had seen Jesse Jackson's name on paper bags for containing money. Yes, he did say that.
I'm speaking with attorney and author Dr. William Pepper. Today's show, The Plot to Kill King, an interview with Dr. William Pepper 39 years into the investigation. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Who were the invaders, and have you ever spoken with any of them?
I've interviewed all of them. Early on, I met with the invaders. I may be one of the few people to actually sit down with each one of them. They were a Black Panther group who were committed to local community services in Memphis, Tennessee, and they were strident, and they were determined and independent, and Dr. King was bringing them into his operation with the precondition of nonviolence. He was bringing them in to assist with respect to the demonstration for the sanitation workers. And they had two rooms at the motel. They were armed, and they had two rooms. And they were there to work with Martin King and SCLC on the sanitation workers' strike. And then suddenly, the afternoon of the assassination, late in the afternoon, they were told to leave. They were told to leave the hotel, that SCLC was not going to pay for their rooms anymore. And they were flabbergasted because they had been working very hard with Dr. King. And they didn't understand why that was to be the case, but nothing surprised them, really, I suppose, and they packed up and left. And I guess they left the motel within 15 minutes of the killing, something like that, right around there. They just moved out of their two rooms.
Could you describe how the removal of the invaders and the moving of Dr. King's hotel room was orchestrated?
Well, again, I wasn't privy to those events, obviously, at that point in time. But I can tell you what witnesses have said. The invaders told me that all of a sudden, and this was, remember, Martin King was killed at about 6:04 when he was standing on the, well, he wasn't killed, but he was shot, according to 6:04 when he was standing on the balcony. And the invaders indicated that all of a sudden, around 20:05, about, 55 minutes before, the assassination around there, 520, 525, somewhere in there, maybe even 530. A hotel staff person knocked on the door and told them that they were now going to have to leave. Like 5:30 in the evening, and they thought, this is strange. They said SCLC was no longer going to pay your bill and you had to leave. They thought this was extraordinary. And when they confronted that hotel staff, the person, with why they were all of a sudden being thrown out of the hotel, they said, well, SCLC is not going to pay your bill, and we've been told to tell you to leave. And they said, well, when they asked as to who gave those instructions, the report was that it was Reverend Jackson. And I'm going to stress again that this is an allegation that was made by a member of the invaders who was at the door when he was told they had to leave. Okay, so that happened, and they just packed up and they left. Now, that has to do with why they left the room. And they had two rooms up on the same level as Dr. King.
Okay.
With respect to the room change, this always was a mystery, and no one understood, and I couldn't. It took me a long time to get information as to why all of a sudden there was this room change, because Dr. King was supposed to have been in room 202, which is a lower ground floor, secluded, secure room at the motel. And instead, he was moved to room 306, which was the balcony room, very highly exposed room. And Ron Tyler Adkins alleged that he was moved because his mother had been given instructions from Frank Holloman, director of police and fire, through his elder brother, Russell, to organize the change in the room. And he was with her when she gave O.C. Evers, who was a black worker who worked for the Adkins family, she called O.C. Evers on the phone, in fact, sent him out to get O.C.'s best phone number from a book they had in another small house that her husband, who had died, was dead, remember, by then, her husband had used. So he got the book, he brought it back, and he was basically, this is what he states, he was at her elbow when she called O.C. Evers. And she told O.C. that she had something for him to do, and it was very important that she speak with him. Could he speak? And O.C. Evers said that he would call her back. And they waited, and then O.C. called back. And she spoke to him on the phone. And again, Ron Tyler Adkins is standing right there. And he's telling me under oath and what he heard his mother say and what the conversation was. And he maintained that he heard her tell O.C. Evers that he, O.C., should go and approach Reverend Jackson and ask him to go to the owner of the motel. The Baileys owned the motel, Walter and Lurley Bailey, and get them to change King's room to 306. And he alleges that this is the conversation that he heard that took place. And she then hung up the phone. And so far as he knows, O.C., did what he was told, but he doesn't know that O.C. did what he was told because he wasn't present where any instructions were given to Bailey. So he was just speculating that this is what happened, and this is what he alleged took place in the deposition that we have. Now, an interesting point is, of course, Dr. King was moved from room 202 to room 306. Walter Bailey at various times has said he was approached by someone in King's organization, and Bailey opposed, and his wife opposed the room change, but they insisted that Dr. King wanted to have a more airy view and a better scene, and therefore, or someone was insisting on the room change. And I'm going to stress that Walter Bailey never named Reverend Jackson, because he didn't. So what we know is a fact is that the room was changed. That we know. What we also know as a fact is that after the assassination, Lurly Bailey, Mrs. Bailey, screamed out at one point right after the shooting, "Oh, my God, what have I done?" And then she ran to her room and locked the door, and she had a stroke. They had to break down the door. They took her to the same hospital as they took Dr. King, St. Joseph's, and she died 5 days later. Now, those are facts, as contrasted with allegations.
What about a surgical nurse's son, Jonathan Shelby? What did he say his mother told him about what happened at St. Joseph's Hospital on the day of the shooting? And you've just mentioned that Dr. King was taken to this hospital after having been shot.
Yes. She was a surgical nurse. Dr. King was taken to the emergency room. They were working on him in the emergency room, and she was in and out of that room along with other medical professionals. At one point, she said, the chief of surgery, Dr. Breen, B-R-E, and Breen Bland, came into the emergency room with two men in suits. Dr. Bland said, "Stop working on that nigger and get out of here. Stop working on that nigger, let him die, and get out of here." And he cleared the room of all these people. As they were going out, she heard them gathering up spit in their mouths, sort of like a type of thing. And that caused her to turn around and just look over her shoulder as she was leaving. And she saw the three of them spit on the body of Dr. King. The catheter had already been removed from his throat, and she saw Dr. Bland take a pillow and put it over his face and head and suffocate him. He was still breathing at the time, so this was effectively the final assassination. Now, what happened was she had to stay in the hospital overnight. She went home the next morning, and she was distraught, terribly depressed and distraught. She called all her family around her, including Jonathan, who was a boy at the time, and she said to the family in their living room, "I don't know why they had to kill him. Why did they have to kill him?" she said. And she was very, very depressed and distraught at this whole thing. Well, Jonathan himself, his mother has passed away, but he kept this with him all his life, and he is now told us this story under oath, and we took the testimony and we filmed it. The interesting thing about Dr. Breen Bland, who was chief of surgery apparently at the hospital, was that he was also the Adkins family doctor, and that Ron Tyler Adkins, the son we've been talking about, was present in a meeting where Dr. Bland was meeting with his father, and said very clearly, "If he's not killed by the bullet, at least make sure he comes to my hospital, and I'll make sure he doesn't get out alive." So we have a second source for this event. Again, Ron Tyler Adkins hearing, and again, these are allegations. Remember that. This doctor talking, who was their family doctor, talking to his father and telling him this. So we have that, and then we have Jonathan Shelby, whose mother, Lula Mae Shelby, was the surgical nurse, and what he had to say. So it does appear that Martin King was killed finally in St. Joseph's Hospital. Now, the question is, would he have survived his wounds? Probably not. I've had Cyril Weck, the forensic pathologist, and Michael Baden, another one, examine the medical reports, and I think they generally believe that he probably would have died anyway. But they didn't know that. That they both said that, and Cyril in particular said there's no way they could have known that. He was still breathing. He was still being treated, and it is possible that he would have survived, but Cyril thought it was unlikely. And I put this exchange of correspondence in the book as well, so the readers can have access to it.
And finally, you write about how Dr. King had evolved beyond the civil rights movement to embrace anti-war and economic justice for all, and that Dr. King was leading a revolution in values to shift American society from materialism to humanism. Why, in your view, was Dr. King considered such a grave threat to ruling powers?
Well, there were two reasons why ultimately he had to be killed. They tried, of course, to intimidate him in various ways. And what you learn about political assassinations is that they only become necessary if there's no other way to get rid of someone who is a threat to the ruling order. And Martin King had reached that position. He was going to lead a group of 500,000 people minimum into Washington, D.C., not to march, but to camp there, to go and visit with their congressmen and senators and try to get them to change the budget and put money back into social programs that had been taken out because of the war. The military believed, I think correctly, that they were not going to be successful, that was not going to happen. The money was not going to be diverted back into social programs, and they were going to get frustrated. And they were afraid they would have a revolution on their hands in the streets of Washington, and they didn't have the troops to put it down. Westmoreland wanted another 200,000 for Vietnam. They didn't have those. So they were afraid they were not going to be able to contain the anger of a spontaneous revolution. Remember, it virtually happened in Paris. Although Charles de Gaulle had André Malraux, who was able to finesse him through it, Lyndon Johnson didn't have anyone of Malraux's capabilities around him. And a 100 cities member had burned that year. In that previous year, over 100 cities burned. The country was on fire. So that was the primary reason I believe they killed him. The secondary reason was, of course, the bottom lines of American military and energy corporations and his opposition to the war in Vietnam, which was growing. And that was what was making him an international human rights leader, not a civil rights leader anymore, but an international human rights leader. And he was threatening the bottom lines of those corporations. So assassination became, again, the last resort. And They had to get rid of him.
Who wrote the poetry that begins every chapter in your book?
I did. I mean, that's poetry is my first love. I'm primarily a poet.
I didn't know that. I think the poetry is wonderful. I was very impressed with it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that. But it's a love of mine, and I insist on bringing it out sometimes.
Dr. William Pepper, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Bonnie, and thanks for all that you do. I know you sometimes have a difficult road to hoe with Pacifica. I know that you're not always allowed to broadcast things that you want to broadcast, and that you have been unfairly reined in, and that makes us aware that the progressive media can only go so far itself, and it's unfortunate. But thanks to people like you, at least you're pushing those limits, and hopefully you'll continue to do so. And thank you very, very much for interviewing me and looking at The Plot to Kill. That's it. The Plot to Kill is the third and last book. It's the end of this saga of mine. with respect to Dr. King. And so that's over. Unfortunately, I still have, I got talked into this, taking on the Sirhan case, the Robert Kennedy case, back in 2007, and I'm still struggling with that one. You know, I worked for Bob Kennedy, and I was only a kid when he ran for the Senate in 64 in New York, and I was his citizen's chairman in Westchester County, and so I have some personal feelings about that case as well. However, we just do what we can do, huh? And you're doing what you do, and please keep it up, and thanks a lot.
Well, thank you so much for those remarks, Dr. Pepper.
You're welcome. Is something happening, yeah, yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly
clear. There's a man with a gun over there. Today's show has been The Plot to Kill King, an interview with Dr. William Pepper, 39 years into the investigation. William Pepper is an attorney, an author, and a poet. He is the author of three books on the assassination of Martin Luther King, Orders to Kill, An Act of State, and his third and latest book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr., published by Skyhorse Publishing in June of 2016. William Pepper's primary work is international commercial law. He has represented governments in the Middle East, Africa, South America, and Asia. He is heavily involved in human rights law, for a time convening the International Human Rights Seminar at Oxford University. Visit his website at williampepper.com. That's williampepper.com. Email him at wfpintlawoxford@aol.com. That's wfpintlawoxford@aol.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaro Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GMB Radio.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. I hope you've enjoyed today's show with Dr. William Pepper. William Pepper will be the keynote speaker at this year's 13th Annual 9/11 Film Festival that takes place on Monday, September 11th, at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland. Doors open at 2 p.m., program from 3 to 10 p.m. And, of course, William Pepper is the author, as you've heard today, of three books on the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Kevin Barrett and Professor Anthony Hall will also be in person, along with 9/11 films and informational tabling in the lobby. That's the 13th Annual 9/11 Film Festival, Monday, September 11th, Grand Lake Theater, Oakland. Doors open at 2 p.m., William Pepper in person giving the evening keynote address. Complete information at sf911truth.org. That's sf911truth.org. Thank you, and I hope to see you there.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today the theme is real versus phony, including a reading from the classic essay, Escaping the Matrix. I hope you'll stay tuned. Here are some things I learned this summer. You can eat radish leaves. Toss them into your salad. They taste like arugula. You can also eat broccoli leaves. Toss them into your salad. They also taste like arugula. Also, fresh broccoli stalks have a lovely, slightly sweet taste. I don't mean agribusiness supermarket broccoli. I mean organic broccoli from a small farm eaten just a couple hours after it was picked. Who knew? By this point, everybody knows that if you want a tasty tomato, don't go anywhere near a supermarket. Grow it yourself or find a farm stand. Corn on the cob, likewise. I learned that years ago. Then, just 2 years ago, I had another revelation. Fresh garlic. Fresh local garlic is twice as moist and three times as flavorful as the hard, mass-produced garlic in the supermarket. In Connecticut, fresh garlic is harder to find than corn or tomatoes. Check out the weekly farmers markets. Fold up the heads of garlic in a paper bag, and they'll keep for maybe 4 or 5 months. That's enough to get you through most of the winter. It was through their garlic that I discovered Tom and Sherry's organic farm. That was just 1 year ago. Tom focuses on the agriculture proper and farm maintenance. Sherry manages the farm's retail store, CSA operation, and the sugar house. Numerous children help out. Anyway, the farm is a lovely place, run by lovely people, with produce that keeps surprising me. I mean, broccoli stalks that actually taste good? Radishes with stems attached and with leaves that taste like arugula? Carrots without any bitterness at all? Why was I never informed that these things exist? Oh, brave new world that has such wonders in it! The farm is near the border of Bolton, Hebron, and Andover, Connecticut. That's Nowheresville to my sophisticated friends in West Hartford. Be that as it may, it's a beautiful 10-mile, mostly rural bicycle ride from my door to their farm. 20 miles round trip. Bicycling is the poor man's psychotherapy, and 20 miles is just enough to be therapeutic. 30 miles is better still, so I usually take a roundabout route. But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot drawing near. Soon the fresh produce will cease, except for squash. Then winter will set in. Bicycle therapy will get cut way back. My outlook on life, which is plenty dark already, will darken further. My stockpile of local garlic will dwindle and decay. I'll be reduced to eating supermarket vegetables, and probably quoting Shakespeare. From hour to hour we ripe and ripe, and hour to hour we rot and rot, and thereby hangs a tale. But for now, it's gather ye radishes while ye may. Time to squirt some oil on the bicycle chain and head for the countryside. Let the yuppies get all excited about their new solar-powered personal fitness monitor, or their new, improved, internet-connected smart thermostat that automatically makes your house 3 degrees warmer because it knows from reading your email that Aunt Ethel is coming for a visit. Thanks, but no thanks. I'm going to pedal out to the country and see if those long, skinny eggplants are worth eating, and if the leeks have come in yet, and if broccoli is still available. I'll let you know when I get back.
The design of the galaxy is in the soil. Patterns are there, all very near. Look down, wisdom abounds. Soil grows the seed, bursts the flower, courts the bee, makes the honey. Honey is free. Soil anchors tree, hosts the nest, cradles the bird, offers song. Song is free. Honey we relish, bird song we cherish, and soil we must revere. The design of the heavens quite near. Soil holds the seed, grows the plant, feeds the body, lifts the breath. Breath is free. Soil houses life, fuels the web, awakens heart, stirs the dance. Dance is free. Breath we do cherish, dancing we relish, and soil we must revere. The design of the galaxy is in the soil.
Time to shift gears a bit, though we'll stay on the subject of real versus phony. Remember the movie The Matrix? After the first reel, it declined into a kind of trite science fiction action flick, but it started off great. A normal 20-something guy named Neo is given the option to take a blue pill or a red pill. The blue pill returns him to his familiar world. However, this world is actually a fake, an engineered fantasy. It is the Matrix, and he's been stuck inside it. The red pill lets him escape the Matrix and discover the real world as it actually exists. This real world is a lot less pleasant than the Matrix world. Neo takes the red pill, and off we go. It's a great premise, an updated version of Plato's famous cave allegory. The movie inspired a very nice essay by a chap named Richard K. Moore in the year 2000. Moore contrasts the establishment's phony account of how the world works with how the world actually works. The propaganda versus the reality. Say, the aim of U.S. foreign policy is to promote democracy and to secure peace worldwide. That's the Matrix version, the version that the powers that be want you to believe. Bust out of the Matrix, and you can see that the real goal of U.S. foreign policy is to further empower and enrich the Rockefellers and such. And democracy be damned. The essayist, Richard Moore, clearly is on the same wavelength as Noam Chomsky, Michael Parenti, and some other folks often heard on New World Notes. This week and next, we'll hear Moore's words, read by Lynn Gurry. Lynn was the founder and longtime host of the radio program Unwelcome Guests. Her reading is from January 2002. Nearly two decades after it was published, Richard Moore's essay still rings true. Here is part one of Escaping the Matrix.
Moore begins the article by asking, "Are you ready for the red pill?" The defining dramatic moment in the film The Matrix occurs just after Morpheus invites Neo to choose between a red pill and a blue pill. The red pill promises the truth, nothing more. Neo takes the red pill and awakes to reality, something utterly different from anything Neo or the audience could have expected. What Neo had assumed to be reality turned out to be only a collective illusion, fabricated by the Matrix and fed to a population that is asleep, cocooned in grotesque embryonic pods. In Plato's famous parable about the shadows on the walls of the cave, true reality is at least reflected in perceived reality. In the Matrix world, true reality and perceived reality exist on entirely different planes. The story is intended as a metaphor, and the parallels that drew my attention had to do with political reality. This article offers a particular perspective on what's going on in the world and how things got to be that way in this era of globalization. From that red pill perspective, everyday media consensus reality, like the Matrix in the film, is seen to be a fabricated collective illusion. Like Neo, I didn't know what I was looking for when my investigation began, but I knew that what I was being told didn't make sense. I read scores of histories and biographies, observing connections between them, and began to develop my own theories about roots of various historical events. I found myself largely in agreement with writers like Noam Chomsky and Michael Parenti, but I also perceived important patterns that others seemed to have missed. When I started tracing historical forces and began to interpret present-day events from a historical perspective, I could see the same old dynamics at work and found a meaning in the unfolding events far different from what official pronouncements proclaimed. Such pronouncements are, after all, public relations fare given out by politicians who want to look good to the voters. Most of us expect rhetoric from politicians and take what they say with a grain of salt. But as my own picture of present reality came into focus, grain of salt no longer worked as a metaphor. I began to see that consensus reality, as generated by official rhetoric and amplified by mass media, bears very little relationship to actual reality. The Matrix was a metaphor I was ready for. In consensus reality, the blue pill perspective, left and right are two ends of the political spectrum. Politics is a tug of war between competing factions carried out by political parties and elected representatives. Society gets pulled this way and that within the political spectrum, reflecting the interests of whichever party won the last election. The left and right are therefore political enemies. Each side is convinced that it knows how to make society better. Each believes the other enjoys undue influence, and each blames the other for the political stalemate that apparently prevents society from dealing effectively with its problems. This perspective on the political process, and on the roles of left and right, is very far from reality. It is a fabricated collective illusion. Morpheus tells Neo that the Matrix is the world that was pulled over your eyes to hide you from the truth. As long as the Matrix exists, humanity cannot be free. Consensus political reality is precisely such a matrix. Later, we'll take a fresh look at the role of left and right and at national politics. But first, we must develop our red pill historical perspective. I've had to condense the arguments to bare essentials. Please see the annotated sources at the end for more thorough treatments of particular topics. Imperialism and the Matrix. From the time of Columbus to 1945, world affairs were largely dominated by competition among Western nations seeking to stake out spheres of influence, control sea lanes, and exploit colonial empires. Each Western power became the core of an imperialist economy whose periphery was managed for the benefit of the core nation. Military might determined the scope of an empire. Wars were initiated when a core nation felt it had sufficient power to expand its periphery at the expense of a competitor. Economies and societies in the periphery were kept backward to keep their populations under control, to provide cheap labor, and to guarantee markets for goods manufactured at the core. Imperialism robbed the periphery not only of wealth, but also of its ability to develop its own societies, cultures, and economies in a natural way for local benefit. The driving force behind Western imperialism has always been the pursuit of economic gain, ever since Isabella commissioned Columbus on his first entrepreneurial voyage. The rhetoric of empire concerning wars, however, has typically been about other things. The white man's burden, bringing true religion to the heathens, manifest destiny, defeating the yellow peril or the Hun, seeking Laban's realm, or making the world safe for democracy. Any fabricated motivation for war or empire would do as long as it appealed to the collective consciousness of the population at the time. The propaganda lies of yesterday were recorded and became consensus history, the fabric of the matrix. While the costs of territorial empire, fleets, colonial administrations, etc., were borne by Western taxpayers generally, the profits of imperialism were enjoyed primarily by private corporations and investors. Government and corporate elites were partners in the business of imperialism. Empires gave government leaders power and prestige, and gave corporate leaders power and wealth. Corporations ran the real business of empire, while government leaders fabricated noble excuses for the wars that were required to keep that business going. Matrix reality was about patriotism, national honor, and heroic causes. True reality was on another plane altogether, that of economics. Industrialization, beginning in the late 1700s, created a demand for new markets and increased raw materials. Both demands spurred accelerated expansion of empire. Wealthy investors amassed fortunes by setting up large-scale industrial and trading operations, leading to the emergence of an influential capitalist elite. Like any other elite, capitalists used their wealth and influence to further their own interests however they could. And the interests of capitalism always come down to economic growth. Investors must reap more than they sow, or the whole system comes to a grinding halt. Thus, capitalism, industrialization, nationalism, warfare, imperialism, and the matrix co-evolved. Industrialized weapon production provided the muscle of modern warfare, and capitalism provided the appetite to use that muscle. Government leaders pursued the politics necessary to expand empire while creating a rhetorical matrix around nationalism to justify those policies. Capitalist growth depended on empire, which in turn depended on a strong and stable core nation to defend it. National interests and capitalist interests were inextricably linked, or so it seemed, for more than two centuries. I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000, continuing. World War II and Pax Americana. 1945 will be remembered as a year World War II ended and the bond of the atomic nucleus was broken. But 1945 also marked another momentous fission, the breaking of the bond between national and capitalist interests. After every previous war, and in many cases after severe devastation, European nations had always picked themselves back up and resumed their competition over empire. But after World War II, a Pax Americana was established. The U.S. began to manage all the Western peripheries on behalf of capitalism generally, while preventing the communist powers from interfering in the game. Capitalist powers no longer needed to fight over investment realms, and competitive imperialism was replaced by collective imperialism. Opportunities for capital growth were no longer linked to the military power of nations apart from the power of America. In his Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Intervention Since World War II, William Blum chronicles hundreds of significant covert and overt interventions, showing exactly how the U.S. carried out its imperial management role. In the post-war years, matrix reality diverged ever further from actual reality. In the post-war matrix world, imperialism had been abandoned, and the world was being, quote, democratized. In the real world, imperialism had become better organized and more efficient. In the matrix world, the U.S., quote, restored order, or, quote, came to the assistance of nations which were being, quote, undermined by Soviet influence, unquote. In the real world, the periphery was being systematically suppressed and exploited. In the Matrix world, the benefit was going to the periphery in the form of countless aid programs. In the real world, immense wealth was being extracted from the periphery. Growing glitches in the Matrix weren't noticed by most people in the West because the post-war years brought unprecedented levels of Western prosperity and social progress. The rhetoric claimed progress would come to all, and Westerners could see it being realized in their own towns and cities. The West became the collective core of a global empire, and exploitative development led to prosperity for Western populations, while generating immense riches for corporations, banks, and wealthy capital investors. Glitches in the Matrix, Popular Rebellion, and Neoliberalism. The parallel agenda of third world exploitation and Western prosperity worked effectively for the first two post-war decades. But in the 1960s, large numbers of Westerners, particularly the young and well-educated, began to notice glitches in the Matrix. In Vietnam, imperialism was too naked to be successfully masked as something else. A major split in American public consciousness occurred as millions of anti-war protesters and civil rights activists punctured the fabricated consensus of the 1950s and declared the reality of exploitation and suppression, both at home and abroad. The environmental movement arose, challenging even the exploitation of the natural world. In Europe, 1968 joined 1848 as a landmark year of popular protest. These developments disturbed elite planners. The post-war regime's stability was being challenged from within the core, and the formula of Western prosperity no longer guaranteed public passivity. A report published in 1975, the report of the Trilateral Task Force on Governability of Democracies, provides a glimpse into the thinking of elite circles. Alan Wolfe discusses this report in Holly Sklar's eye-opening work, Trilateralism. Wolfe focuses especially on the analysis Harvard professor Samuel P. Huntington presented in a section of the report entitled The Crisis of Democracy. Huntington is an articulate promoter of elite policy shifts and contributes pivotal articles to publications such as the Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs. Huntington tells us that democratic societies cannot work, quote-unquote, unless the citizenry is, quote, passive. The, quote, democratic surge of the 1960s represented an, quote, excess of democracy, which must be reduced if governments are to carry out their traditional domestic and foreign policies. Huntington's notion of traditional policies is expressed in a passage from the report, quote, to the extent that the United States was governed by anyone during the decades after World War II, it was governed by the president acting with the support and cooperation of key individuals and groups in the executive office, the federal bureaucracy, Congress, and the more important businesses, banks, law firms, foundations, and media, which constitute the private sector's establishment. Close quote. In these few words, Huntington spells out the reality that electoral democracy has little to do with how America is run, and summarizes the kind of people who are included within the elite planning community. Who needs conspiracy theories when elite machinations are clearly described in public documents like these? Besides failing to deliver popular passivity, the policy of prosperity for Western populations had another downside, having to do with Japan's economic success. Under the Pax Americana umbrella, Japan had been able to industrialize and become an imperial player. The prohibition on Japanese rearmament had become irrelevant. With Japan's then lower living standards, Japanese producers could undercut prevailing prices and steal market share from Western producers. Western capital needed to find a way to become more competitive on world markets, and Western prosperity was standing in the way. Elite strategists, as Huntington showed, were fully capable of understanding these considerations, and the requirements of corporate growth created a strong motivation to make the needed adjustments in both reality and rhetoric. If popular prosperity could be sacrificed, there were many obvious ways Western capital could be made more competitive. Production could be moved overseas to low-wage areas, allowing domestic unemployment to rise. Unions could be attacked and wages forced down, and people could be pushed into temporary and part-time jobs without benefits. Regulations governing corporate behavior could be removed. Corporate and capital gains taxes could be reduced, and the revenue losses could be taken out of public service budgets. Public infrastructures could be privatized, the services reduced to cut costs, and then they could be milked for easy profits when they deteriorated from neglect. These are the very policies and programs launched during the Reagan-Thatcher years in the U.S. and Britain. They represent a systematic project of increasing corporate growth at the expense of popular prosperity and welfare. Such a real agenda would have been unpopular, and a corresponding matrix reality was fabricated for public consumption. The matrix reality used terms like deregulation, reduced taxes, and privatization, but around them was woven an economic mythology. The old, failed, laissez-faire doctrine of the 1800s was reintroduced with the help of Milton Friedman's Chicago School of Economics, and less government became the proud modern theme in America and Britain. Sensible regulations had restored financial stability after the Great Depression and had broken up anti-competitive monopolies such as the Rockefeller Trust and AT&T. But in the new matrix reality, all regulations were considered bureaucratic interference. Reagan and Thatcher preached the virtues of individualism and promised to, quote, get government off people's backs, unquote. The implication was that everyday individuals were to get more money and freedom, but in reality, the primary benefits would go to corporations and wealthy investors. The academic term for laissez-faire economics is economic liberalism, and hence the Reagan-Thatcher revolution has come to be known as the neoliberal revolution. It brought a radical change in actual reality by returning to the economic philosophy that led to sweatshops, corruption, and robber baron monopolies in the 19th century. It brought an equally radical change in matrix reality, a complete reversal in the attitude that was projected regarding government. Government policies had always been criticized in the media, but the institution of government had always been respected, reflecting the traditional bond between capitalism and nationalism. With Reagan, we had a sitting president telling us that government itself was a bad thing. Many of us may have agreed with him, but such a sentiment had never before found official favor. Soon, British and American populations were beginning to applaud the destruction of the very democratic institutions that provided their only hope of participation in the political process.
Lynn Gary, reading Richard K. Moore's classic essay, Escaping the Matrix. We'll hear the rest next week. You've been listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, bidding illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.
you're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No shorthand.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. I'm joined on the show today by Dr. Graham McQueen. Graham McQueen was the founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University, where he taught for 30 years. He is co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. McQueen holds a Ph.D. in Buddhist Studies from Harvard University. He's the author of the book, The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, which came out in 2014, and he was one of the organizers of the Toronto hearings in 2011. And he's a member of the 9/11 Consensus Panel. And he joins me today to discuss an article he recently published on some recent polls taken in the United Kingdom. Graham McQueen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cheryl. It's always great to talk to you.
Yes, and you recently published an article on the great website globalresearch.ca called 9/11 Truth, British Muslims Overwhelmingly Reject the Official 9/11 Story. Could you tell us who put on that poll, a little bit about it?
Sure. The poll itself was published just this last December 2016, and I kind of chanced upon it when I was doing research for a different article. So I read it and was quite fascinated both by the poll results and by the way the poll was interpreted. So that's why I wrote the article. The group that sponsored the poll is called Policy Exchange. It's a think tank in Britain. We can euphemistically say it's a conservative think tank, not to say right-wing. The current chair of the Board of Trustees of Policy Exchange is David Frum, who is a well-known neoconservative, co-author of a book with Richard Perle, and therefore very much in that circle of what we often call neocons. The think tank Policy Exchange has a special relationship with the Conservative Party in the UK, is considered important, is even sometimes thought of as a kind of breeding ground for young conservative intellectuals and politicians in the UK. So it's interesting that they would be the ones to carry out a big poll, and they didn't actually carry it out. They delegated that to ICM, which is a polling company, but they're the ones who presumably designed the original questions and who wanted to do this. And it's a large poll, seems to be decently done scientifically if you overlook the actual questions that they ask and their goals and their interpretation. So 3,000, roughly, Muslims in the UK surveyed, and they also surveyed a control group of a little over 2,000 people who were meant to represent the UK population as a whole, so they could then contrast the control group with British Muslims. So that's the gist.
Great. And David Frum, just so people know, wasn't he involved in the Bush administration in the build-up to the war and taking us to Iraq?
Yeah, Tim. I'm afraid to say he came from my country, Canada, one of our great contributions.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, his mother was a very famous, a very well-known journalist in Canada. And, of course, it's a little creepy when you think of a group that was actually described by a major Muslim organization in Britain. The Muslim Council of Britain described Policy Exchange as, quote, an anti-Muslim organization. So think about it. You know, a party which represents the political right in the UK, which is thought of as antagonistic to Muslims by major organization of Muslims in the UK, decides to carry out this detailed survey, which, you know, breaks down Muslims into different groups according to where they're living in the country and asks very detailed questions about what they believe and think and their values and so on and so forth. I mean, this is a gift, really, to British police, British intelligence. You begin to see that there is a kind of a fuzzy line, actually, between a public opinion poll and an intelligence operation. And I'm not suggesting that British intelligence was directly involved in it. I have no reason to believe they were, but I'm just saying it would be very useful to them, even though the results clearly show that British Muslims are not the slightest bit interested in carrying out acts of violence. Quite the contrary, they are less sympathetic to acts of political violence and terrorism than the control group. So in that sense, there's nothing very interesting here in terms of targeting Muslims. Yet, despite that, Policy Exchange manages to try and find a way to interpret this poll to make Muslims look kind of scary and dangerous. Yeah, it's clearly one of their aims.
Yeah, and we've done a good job of that here in this country, too, with our media. So that seems to be the goal. So tell us a bit about the poll. What were some of the questions, and how did they respond?
Oh, well, there's all sorts of questions that ask them about, you know, how do they feel about police presence and general political views, questions that are meant to test their loyalty to the UK and their strong feelings about their religion. But the question that I focused on, actually more than one, but a few of them in the poll, for my article had to do with the issue of 9/11. I thought it was interesting that a poll of British Muslims would even ask this, for one thing. But then, of course, I found the results interesting. So here was the question. Who do you think was responsible for 9/11? And the responses were, they were given five choices, by the way. First was Al-Qaeda / Muslim terrorists. Then it said Jews. Then it said the American government. Then other, and then don't know. Well, 52% said they didn't know, which is interesting. But even more interesting is the fact that 4% said Al-Qaeda or Muslim terrorists. In other words, an almost insignificant number of British Muslims believe the official narrative of 9/11. Because however you want to express that official narrative, that official account of 9/11, the fact that it was supposedly carried out by Muslim terrorists is definitely an essential part of the narrative. So if you don't believe that, you really are not a believer in the official narrative. This means that here we have a population of people in the middle of the UK, in other words, in the middle of the country, which is really strongly trying to convince them, and by that I mean all major media, all parties in government, that, in fact, this was an act carried out by Muslim terrorists, and they almost all reject it. Now, that's a strong result. That's a very interesting result. I'm not surprised that our conservative interpreters were worried about that or wanted to make something out of it. Also, we find 31% said the American government was responsible for 9/11. Mm. So, okay, there's a bit of a contrast there. 4% Muslim terrorists, 31% American government. Now, I don't want to pretend this is hugely surprising. There have been lots of polls about 9/11 before, and we can talk about that if you want, what the findings are from it. Yeah, well, the first thing that's obvious is that Muslims in the world, speaking in general terms here, have never bought the official story of 9/11 the way, for example, we in North America, we meaning non-Muslim mainstream people of various faiths and non-faiths, have bought it. I mean, they just haven't. So you can find many polls on this, and they go over many different countries. This is Muslims from, but not all Arabs. For example, Turks are great disbelievers in the official narrative. They're not Arabs. People from Pakistan, they're not Arabs. Pakistanis are probably the strongest group in the world in terms of rejecting the official story, but also the Arab world. So, for example, Egypt, they don't believe it. Probably the percentage of Muslims worldwide who accept the official narrative, based on the polls we have, is not more than 17%. That's the maximum.
In your article, I noticed you have two other polls in here, a 2008 and a 2011 poll, and it looks like as time goes on, less and less Muslims believe the official story because the numbers keep going down.
That's why I gave those two results. In the 2008 one, there were 21% roughly who assigned guilt to Al-Qaeda, and by 2011 it was 17%. And we find this result generally when we're lucky enough to have the same question asked in the same words in more than one poll. Generally speaking, skepticism, as far as I can tell, has been increasing. Skepticism toward the official narrative has been increasing over time, not only with Muslims, but with others as well. So that's why I say I think it's probably no more than 17% of Muslims worldwide accept the official narrative of 9/11. So in that sense, no surprise that Muslims are rejecting it. But still, 4% is lower as a percentage of people that believe the story. It's lower than usual. I could only find one result lower than that, actually. It was one poll done in Pakistan a couple of years ago, which had 3% of people. But basically, what I just find it fascinating that this population has managed to achieve its own worldview, or at least its own interpretation of this incident, and be resilient in maintaining that and even increasing that in the midst of all this propaganda that's going on around it. And of course, as it happens, because of 10 years of research, I think British Muslims are right. I mean, if I thought they were wrong, I would have a different view of this perhaps, but I think they're right.
Absolutely.
So, kind of encouraging.
Yeah, it is encouraging. And I have a question around that. You know, I'm wondering why more Muslims don't speak out if they get this in great numbers. And I guess I understand partly why they don't, but I'd be curious to know your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I think the very fact of how this poll was carried out gives us an idea of why they don't speak out. I mean, they're being intensely studied. They're being considered suspicious. Their loyalty is being questioned. There's a string of quote-unquote terrorist events that keeps happening in the West, which are immediately blamed on them. And that just goes to maintain the global war on terror and to maintain the fear and the suspicion and all that. Now, in my view, the majority of those terrorist incidents are frauds, just like 9/11. They
Yes.
have signs all over them that they are state operations meant to keep this absurd conflict, war on terror, going. And I don't say they're all frauds, but the ones I have actually begun looking into usually bear the same signs that we're familiar with, or having studied 9/11 and the anthrax attacks. And those two I've studied in great detail. And so when I see the same signs coming up, I go, oh, not this again. I think at this point in history, we have to assume that when one of these events happens, our initial assumption has to be that it's a false flag attack, it's a state operation, and that's the assumption. We could be wrong, but in that case, we'll need evidence to convince us we're wrong. In other words, my own perspective has changed from what it would have been maybe 12 years ago. 12 years ago, I might have said, well, I know there's lots of state deception. I've been studying war for a long time, but let's assume the official story of one of these things is correct, unless we see evidence to the contrary. I don't believe that anymore. There's so much fraud, I think we have to flip it and say, I'm going to assume it's a fake unless I see evidence.
Until proven otherwise, right.
Yeah.
And they all have some of the same characteristics. Maybe you could share with us what are some of the characteristics that you see that all of these have that lead us to believe they're false.
Well, one of the things is that they're usually able to identify the perpetrator very quickly. Another is that they often kill the perpetrator, so that there's no trial, there's no airing for the public of evidence. Police get to say what they'll show us and what they won't show us. And even what they do show us is often flimsy in the extreme. Their so-called perpetrators often make a point of leaving their identification at the scene. You know, they accidentally leave it in the taxi, as with the Charlie Hebdo attacks, or they have their passport on them when they're shot down, which is the case mm-hmm. with Michael Zihafibou in Ottawa, 2014. Again, a couple of recent incidents. Once again, we have identification found. I mean, come on, you know. And that obviously reminds us of the 9/11 case of, actually, it was a whole host of identification found at various sites. The most famous one is the passport found at the World Trade Center, which somehow escaped the conflagration, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Satam al-Sukami. I think that's the passport that was found. But that was just an example. Then we had in Pennsylvania, we had all kinds of identification.
Their bandanas or something. Yeah.
even though there's no plane.
Right.
And they found all kinds of, you know, business cards and an ID and stuff, supposedly at the Pentagon. I mean, that was so stupid. I can't see how anyone could believe it. So when we see this being replicated again, so really you can come up with a checklist, and there are such. Some people have come up with checklists.
Mm-hmm.
You can find them on the internet. You know, if you find the following 12 characteristics, it's probably a fraud.
I know one of them is that there's usually some kind of a drill that's gone on before or during the event, and also often the perpetrators are known by the FBI and have connections to
these government and intelligence agencies.
Right. We had both of those, for example, in October 2014 in Canada, we had two so-called Muslim terrorist events that happened very quickly, that is, very closely together. One was, I think, October 20th, one was 22nd. These are really rare in Canada. And they had everything that we're talking about here. They had drills. They had all kinds of foreknowledge. I think our federal police denied that there was any warning at all. And actually, there were at least six, some of them very specific. There was a huge training exercise that had been going on for some time, which was carried out to simulate an attack in Quebec followed by an attack in another city. Well, guess what? October 20th, province of Quebec, attack. 2 days later, attack in another city, Ottawa, and so on. So that one was there. What was the other one you mentioned? Oh, the RCMP knew these people. Yeah, sure. Well, the Maudis had actually been having regular visits with one of these guys, and the other guy had a big criminal record, and, you know, and they knew all about him, and he was a homeless man who somehow suddenly managed to get hold of a car and a gun. And I wrote a whole report about that one. It was so silly. So those are two more characteristics. We find them all over the place. There they are, Boston Marathon, good training going on.
Oh, yes. So, and another example of the supposed perpetrators being connected to the FBI and had been watched by them, and they'd been to their home and all
right.
of that.
So your initial question was, why do Muslims not speak out? And I think we're answering it as we go along. I mean, they're under attack. It's not paranoia. Most of them are ordinary folks who want to live a normal life in the country that they're in. And if they're in the West, they want to, to a large extent, integrate. I don't mean give up their religion and all their beliefs and so on, but on the whole, they want to integrate. They want their kids to be able to go to school without being harassed. They don't want people looking at them like terrorists when they go to work in the day. And so it's been my experience, certainly within my own country, knowing the Muslim community in my own city and in neighboring cities, that generally on this issue, they keep their head down. And that doesn't mean that some of them aren't grateful when others of us are willing to speak out about it. It's safer for me to speak about it than it is for them.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Now, in this poll that was done that you were talking about here in Britain, how did they twist or spin the results? And that's why you were motivated to write the article.
Well, one of the things, I mean, they couldn't do much about violence since, as I say, Muslims answered questions about political violence by being less sympathetic to it than the control group. So they latched on to a couple of other terms or other ideas. One was that somehow Muslims were racists and were blaming it on Jews. But the others were two different terms. One was conspiracy theory and one is extremism. So they asked this question about 9/11, I think, partly to entrap the population and to say, look at them, they're conspiracy theorists. And we'll now argue that conspiracy theory is very dangerous, that it feeds into what they call extremism and terrorism, and that therefore it's scary and we need to try and work on that. So the results that I gave you would show that Muslims in the UK don't believe the official story of 9/11. Somehow Policy Exchange wants to make that into a scary finding. Now they do it. First of all, they ask several questions in the poll in which they use the term conspiracy theory and in which they use the term extremism. They never define either term. Okay? They never define. That's really, really important because these are two very important terms in the war on terror. Conspiracy theory has been just a gold mine for people who are trying to smear those of us who question the official story. It sounds so intellectually sophisticated. Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist, ha, 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 whereas I am sophisticated. But, of course, you don't define it, because if you define it, it'll turn out that what you're saying makes no sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, conspiracy theory, the obvious meaning of that is a theory which asserts that a conspiracy took place. Right? I mean, that's the obvious meaning, and that's the way it was used, for example, after the John Kennedy's assassination. There were two choices. One was that there was a lone gunman, usually said to be Lee Harvey Oswald, and the other was that there was a conspiracy, meaning more than one person. And a conspiracy is where two or more people get together in secret to plan an immoral or illegal act, right? So what would that mean to say that there's a conspiracy theory about 9/11? I mean, it's obvious there's no lone gunman option.
Right.
No way one person, no matter how evil they are, they didn't do the whole thing. They didn't hijack four planes simultaneously, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So it's obvious, in other words, that regardless of who you think did 9/11, it was two or more people. Well, it was more than two. It was multiple people. Obviously, it was a crime. And obviously, they didn't plan it in public, right? They mm-hmm. planned it in secret. Therefore, it was a conspiracy. And therefore, using the obvious meaning of the term conspiracy theory, there is no theory that can possibly account for 9/11 except a conspiracy theory. And therefore, the decision we have to make isn't between conspiracy theory and something else. It's between the government, the official conspiracy theory, in which Al-Qaeda are the conspirators, and one or the other conspiracy, right?
Right.
So, for example, of course I think people conspired. Of course. And a lot of them were people in the state, in the government of the U.S. Others were, may have been in foreign intelligence agencies, so on and so forth. So I'm going on at length about this just to say that, as you obviously already know this, but I'm saying this for people listening, you know, this conspiracy theory term is usually meant purely as a propaganda term. And the people who use it very seldom are willing to unpack it, because it just doesn't work when you begin looking at it. So here we have a survey in which people are asked about conspiracy theories without defining it. And they're asked about extremism, which is also a very important term, and there's no definition. So here's an example of a question asked on the poll in the UK. Quote, "From time to time, we all come across so-called conspiracy theories," and that's put in quotation marks, "which supposedly explain events in a different way to commonly held beliefs. You may have seen or heard about conspiracy theories about, for example, the attacks on the Twin Towers in New York on 9/11. To what extent do you agree or disagree with the following statements?" They then give a few, and here's one statement. "Conspiracy theories are started by extremists trying to dupe Muslims into support for their views." Okay? I mean, when I read that in the poll, I just started to laugh. I mean, that's obvious propaganda. First of all, this violates the basic principles of public polling. You never ask a question using a term that you don't define and that is seriously unclear. So that's the first sign that this isn't a sincere public poll. It's something else going on. And I think what's going on is a form of entrapment, actually, trying to get people to say certain things that can be used against them.
Right. And another word they used is duped. Like, if you believe in conspiracy theories, you've been duped by extremists. And who wants to be duped?
Well, who wants to be duped, indeed?
Yeah.
And who wants to be associated with extremism, which is the other term here? Because you have to remember that there's a whole thing, debate going on in the UK for some years now about this concept of extremism. Finally, I found it defined in a UK government document from around 2011, where extremism is defined as something, I'm sorry, I don't have the thing here, but it's something like public opposition to fundamental British values. Think about that for a minute. Well, they give examples of fundamental British values, and the examples are things you and I would, I'm sure, like democracy and tolerance of different faiths and so on. But there are several things going on here. First of all, those values are not distinctly British. There are people all kinds of parts of the world who affirm those. But secondly, those are precisely the values that the war on terror is putting at risk. And I'm suspicious of anybody who defines a term like extremism in terms of national values. It reminds me of, you know, the House on un-American
activities. Yeah.
As soon as you're talking about somebody's in trouble if they're un-American or they're un-British or something, then you've got something really fishy going on here.
Yes.
So extremism is a term that's under debate in the UK for good reason. I think it should be rejected completely. But part of the reason it's being defined that way is because the people in government who are pushing this notion of extremism do not want it to be, how shall I put this, they do not want violence to be an essential part of the definition. I mean, if extremism were to mean what many people assume it means, that people are doing some kind of horrible, unjustified violence, then obviously Sherrold and Graham McQueen aren't extremists, because we're not pushing violence. But they want us to be part of that circle, just like they want British Muslims as a whole to be in danger of this thing called extremism. So they are deliberately creating a category, and they say this, like when he was Prime Minister, Cameron publicly said that he was against all forms of extremism, including, folks, nonviolent extremism. That's his term. And what we see in this poll that I'm discussing here is that the current effort by the political right in the UK is to make so-called conspiracy theories, generally undefined, okay, to make that a part of this thing called nonviolent extremism.
Yes.
Where I'm going.
Yes, so it's an attack on anybody who challenges the official story.
Absolutely. An attack which has a very scary direction here, because what they're really heading for, and they've got legislation in the works in the UK, is to not only make so-called conspiracy theorists, you know, like us, to not only make us taboo and somehow polluted and ridiculous and all those things which they've been trying to do all along, but to actually make it illegal to hold such opinions is something we need to be aware of this.
I agree. And now with the attack on the, quote, fake news, they're trying to get at all the alternative outlets where we can share this information. And they're attacking us that way, too. And they're going to make that even illegal to do. Yeah, it is a major attack. I see that. I'm glad you're bringing that up.
Yeah, it's a dangerous assault which needs to be checked. And unfortunately, mainstream media, political parties have had a fair bit of success in the West in this employment of terms like conspiracy theory. And so it's possible that they'll get some fishy law through a parliament here or there that will make it much harder for us to have freedom of expression and freedom of research and to find out and communicate the truth about our times.
You've just been listening to the first part of an interview with Dr. Graham McQueen, Canadian professor and author. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of that interview. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. With the events in Charlottesville, Virginia as our fulcrum, we'll examine the persistence of white supremacy and white nationalism. How is it that its poison still courses through America's bloodstream? And how the Trump White House is providing the transfusions that breed new life into fascism. Well, Public Enemy and we are still fighting the powers that be. And now with us is Professor of Comparative and Foreign Law at Yale Law School. His book include Harsh Justice, The Origins of Reasonable Doubt and the Verdict of Battle, Hitler's American Model, The United States and the Making of Nazi Race Law, James Whitman. In Hitler's American Model, Whitman looks at the ultimate ugly irony that when Nazis rejected American practices, it was sometimes not because they found them too enlightened, but too harsh. James Whitman, your book is stunningly, painfully well-timed against the vivid and deadly reemergence of fascist mayhem and death in Charlottesville.
Yeah, it sure turned out to be more timely than I would have expected or certainly hoped.
Well, educate. Nazism really triumphed in Germany during the high era of Jim Crow laws in the United States. Did the American regime of racial oppression in any way really inspire the Nazis?
I think it did. The research that I did actually shocked me. I didn't expect to find what I found, but I found exactly that. Inspiration and influence, I should say, particularly on the Nuremberg Laws of 1935. It's important to emphasize at the beginning that the Holocaust was not yet on the horizon in the early 30s when Hitler first seized power. The Nazis had different goals in mind, the goals you find in the Nuremberg Laws. They wanted to create some form of second-class citizenship for the Jews and ban sex and marriage between Jews and what they regarded as pure racial Germans. Those programs were programs for which you could find plenty of material, as they called it, in American law, and they studied American law carefully.
Now, we should say that the Nuremberg Laws, for people who may not know them, were really the centerpiece of anti-Jewish legislation of the Nazi regime.
They were. That's exactly right. They were sufficiently notorious that people at least may have heard the name. I imagine they have. The Nuremberg Laws really were the first big step on the road to what eventually became the Holocaust, but which was what was not at the moment the Holocaust at that time, as I said.
Well, you show that the Nuremberg Laws were crafted in an atmosphere of considerable attention to the precedents of American race laws. American race laws had to offer. German praised American practices. Already found in Hitler's Mein Kampf was continuous throughout the early 1930s. The most radical Nazi lawyers were eager advocates of the use of American models. So tell us more about, for example, Jim Crow segregation laws and what they had to do with and influence and why they appealed to or how they appealed to Nazi radicals.
Sure. First of all, you're exactly right. Hitler in Mein Kampf described the United States as the one state that was making progress toward the creation of a healthy race order, if you can imagine. In fact, that's how I began the research. I pulled Mein Kampf off the shelf and found that line and wondered what more there might be to be found. And boy, was there a lot to be found in the sources. You're also right that it was particularly the radicals, the most vicious faction of the Nazis, who were the greatest supporters of American models, who wanted to bring American law to Germany. Part of what interested them, of course, was the thing that we remember about that period, namely Jim Crow segregation. But it's a mistake to imagine that that's all there was to it. They certainly were interested in segregation, although what we discover when we look at the sources is that the radical Nazis in particular regarded Jim Crow segregation as inappropriate for German circumstances, as one of them said in 1934, Jim Crow segregation is a program that can work with American blacks because they're already oppressed. But the Jews in Germany, so he went on, the Jews in Germany are too rich and powerful. We have to use harsher measures than Jim Crow. Other Nazis were in favor of bringing Jim Crow in as they regarded it as a relatively mild form of establishing a racist order in Germany. But when they looked at the United States, they saw other things than Jim Crow. And in fact, the most important forms of American inspiration involved other kinds of law. And the first thing you have to remember here is something that we very easily forget, namely that American racist legislation in the early 20th century extended far beyond Jim Crow segregation. You know, we think of the history of American racism, our sense of what took place was formed very much by the experience of the civil rights era, which was, of course, directed fundamentally against segregation, against separate water fountains and all the rest of the horror of segregation. But as Nazis looked at America in the 1930s, they saw a much wider range of racist programs and racist legislation. And racist legislation that extended far beyond the racist South. What Hitler was praising in Mein Kampf in particular was American immigration law. American immigration law, which was pretty much expressly race-based. It was designed to keep undesirable races out. That's law essentially from the 1920s, although some of it extends back to anti-Asian measures in the late 19th century. American immigration law was, of course, not law that emanated from the South. That was national legislation, and as I just suggested, it wasn't directed exclusively or even primarily against African Americans. It was directed against Asians. It was directed against Eastern Europeans. The Nazis found that extraordinarily interesting, as other far right-wingers did too. American immigration law was a subject of discussion, a topic for praise for European far right-wingers for decades, really, before Hitler came to power. American immigration law was only part of it, though. American law also included exactly what the Nazis were looking for in the Nuremberg laws, forms of second-class citizenship. Now, again, some of those forms of second-class citizenship involved in particular the black population, especially in the South, in particular through measures like poll taxes and literacy tests. African Americans were denied the meaningful right to vote. That's something we're seeing again today. But as a matter of law, full citizenship rights of African Americans couldn't be denied to them because the 14th Amendment guaranteed their citizenship. But there were other populations for whom American law had created forms of second-class citizenship of great interest to the Nazis. These included in particular Native Americans down until 1924, and especially, entirely forgotten today, Filipinos. After the U.S. conquered the Philippines in 1898, the Supreme Court consented to the creation of a form of second-class citizenship for them, calling them non-citizen nationals. That's a term that the Nazis would use once again for the Jews. All of those forms of law extended far beyond the segregationist South. The U.S., from the Nazi point of view and in reality, was a much, much wider-ranging, broader-based racist order than that. But the kind of American law that really inspired the Nazis most, and especially the radicals, was anti-miscegenation law. That is, law banning and sometimes criminalizing threatening harsh punishment for interracial marriage. Anti-miscegenation law, once again, was not confined to the South, and it wasn't just about African Americans. 30 states had anti-miscegenation statutes. Many of them were directed against Asians and a variety of other populations, Native Americans, once again. And it was especially these anti-miscegenation statutes that excited Nazi radicals and the Nazis more broadly, and it's their influence that we can see most directly on the Nuremberg laws.
The Nazis had a shared commitment, your book shows, of white supremacy, in part because they realized that it had been successful in helping create America's dynamism, especially its economic power. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, that's exactly what they thought. I hope they were wrong in thinking it, of course. But one of the reasons, inevitably, that the Nazis were interested in the American model or in American models is that the U.S. then, as now, was the dominant power in the world. Hitler wanted to create a Germany that was also going to be the dominant power in the world. And when the Nazis asked themselves what it was that had powered America's rise, inevitably they pointed to American racism. What else could it have been? Now, some of them were certainly pessimistic about the future of U.S. power. They thought that eventually race mixing would destroy the United States, although Hitler himself was unusually optimistic about the future of the U.S., especially in the early 1930s. In the late 1930s, things began to shift. But certainly when the Nazis looked at the U.S., they saw what they thought was not only a racist order, but a hugely successful racist order. The model of the U.S. also mattered to them a great deal because the U.S. was a land-based empire. They were thrilled by the history of the U.S. conquest of the West. In particular, in the periods that I discuss in my book, when the Nazis moved into Eastern Europe in the horrific period of the early 1940s, the period of the Holocaust, many Nazis, Hitler included, often invoked the American conquest of the West and the American, well, near extermination of Native Americans as a model for what they were doing, too. The U.S. was the great land empire, and one whose success, the Nazis were convinced, had to do with its ruthless program of establishing white supremacy across the continent.
And the American Immigration Act of 1924, which conditioned entry into the United States on race-based tables of national origins, earned particular praise of Hitler in Mein Kampf. Relate more about that to us.
There was first a statute in 1921, and then, as you say, the Immigration Act of 1924, which were based on national quota systems. The purpose of these statutes was to limit immigration, especially from Eastern Europe, and to favor what Americans regarded as the compatible races, that is, not only the English, but also the Germans, and other Northern European Scandinavians, exactly the groups, of course, that would constitute what Hitler imagined to be the ruling races of the world. The same sorts of purposes, the same idea of what counted as a desirable race, as a strong race, lay in the background of those statutes in 1921 and especially 1924. Their aim, among other things, was to keep out Eastern European Jews, of course. The Nazis were aware of that. As I say, there was a prehistory of all of this. In the 19th century, anti-immigration measures directed particularly against Asians. That's something we see not only in the United States, but in other parts of the English-speaking world, like Australia in particular, another model to some extent for the Nazis. In the 19th century, we begin to see a tremendous panic in these parts of the globe that have been settled by the British about the appearance of Chinese and later Japanese, a tremendous desire to keep out those undesirables, if I can put the term in quotes. That long tradition reemerged in a big way in 1924, and the national quota system established in 1924 lasted in the United States until it was repealed in 1965, but the repeal was put into full effect only in 1968, so until the very end of the civil rights era. American immigration law was dominated by these more or less unapologetically racist attitudes right throughout most of the 20th century, the first two-thirds of the 20th century. It's worth emphasizing and talking about Hitler's admiration for those statutes, something that I think shouldn't be surprising, but that's easily forgotten, how much the Nazi movement and other far right-wing movements resemble current right-wing movements in putting opposition to open immigration at the core of their program.
And we can go back even further than that. One of the things that had been pointed out was in a speech given by Hitler in 1928, of course, he looked admiringly at the United States for the beginning with the extermination of Native Americans.
He did. It's really depressing to read this stuff, I gotta say. Yeah, he gave a speech in which he spoke admiringly of the Americans for having, if I can remember the phrase, gunned down the millions of Redskins to a few hundred thousand and confined the remainder in camps where they could be watched. And then went on to say that Europeans had better do the same thing if they were ever going to have any hope of competing with the Americans.
And I still think that this is a powerful, critical, important book to read, Hitler's American Model, the United States, and the Making of Nazi Race Law. If anyone still doubts America's ongoing racism and status and really leader of the pack, consider our country's blood laws. And I want you to go back and talk more about that. The Nazis considered Jews as vectors of mongrelization, but much of America was infected with the same race madness.
Sure was. And it's here on this topic in particular that we see the phenomenon that you mentioned before, Nazis finding American law too harsh. One of the things that Nazis found most intriguing, if not always perfectly inspiring about American law, was the American law for classifying who belonged to what race. This is, of course, a problem. I mean, there are mixed-race people who appear before court, and there are always questions about which race they should be classified as belonging to. America had some extraordinarily harsh classification law. The most famous example is the one-drop rule, which you find in some states, not all. That is the rule that any person with one drop of black blood counted as black. But there were a whole variety of other means of determining who counted as a member of the disfavored race or disfavored races, once again, especially blacks in this case. There were also a variety of techniques that courts used, sometimes kind of seat-of-the-pants improvisatory ways of deciding that a litigant before the court was actually black or actually white. This stuff in the United States was naturally of great interest to the Nazis, and they studied it quite carefully, I should say. We have a remarkable stenographic transcript of a planning meeting for the Nuremberg Laws in 1934, which began when the Minister of Justice presented a memo on American law and involved a great deal of discussion of American law, and in particular, these questions in American law, how to classify individuals. But the Nazis themselves thought that this American law went much too far. They described the one-drop rule, if you can imagine that, as inhumane. Said, you can't do that to people. It's not fair. Their own system for classifying who counted as a Jew, as it emerged after the Nuremberg Laws, only definitively characterized persons as Jews if they had three Jewish grandparents. If they had two Jewish grandparents, they were only classified as Jews if they practiced Judaism or married another Jew. That, by American standards, was an extraordinarily mild approach. That is a less far-reaching definition of who belonged to the disfavored race than you could find in basically any of the U.S. states that had anti-miscegenation statutes. And that's really quite a remarkable testimony to the nastiness of American law.
And popular Nazi magazines actually praised lynching as the natural resistance of the Volk to an alien race that is attempting to gain the upper hand.
That is it exactly. I mean, I'll tell you, as I say, the book turns out to be much more timely. I handed in the final version of this book on the eve of Election Day. I had no idea that we would see violence in the U.S. that looked like the kind of violence the Nazis were praising. But you're exactly right. They produced propaganda articles which praised lynching, at least American lynching, and that the Nazis themselves thought that the state should be doing those kinds of things, not private parties. So lynching of the American kind is another thing the Nazis were not eager to import. But exactly as you say, they regarded it as the healthy response of the folk to the presence of an alien race trying to get the upper hand. It's really appalling to read these things.
So the similarity between the Ku Klux Klan and fascist paramilitary groups like the Brown Shirts compared to the post-Reconstruction order in the South to the Nazi system. So your motivation in writing this book, and in your mind, why is it so powerful and important to know this as we confront the latest episodes of violence perpetrated by neo-Nazis, by white nationalists, by white supremacists in Charlottesville?
Well, it's first of all, of course, essential that we realize that white supremacy is not a foreign import into the United States. It's an indigenous product. We've had it for a very, very long time. We must remember that. It's not that somebody read about Hitler and, reverse of the pattern I've been describing, experienced a flash of inspiration and decided to bring the same thing to the U.S. We pioneered a lot of this stuff going very, very far back. It's also essential that we engaged in these white supremacist practices in the U.S. without ever abandoning our democratic institutions, without ever abandoning our American Constitution. That's very, very important. What it means is that those institutions, in fact, let me go a step further than that. As you try to understand what it was that the Nazis found so inspiring about American law, one thing that you discover is that the white supremacist legislation and the court decisions that I've described were the product of the American common law and the product of our political process. We have a system of law which is unusually open to strong political influence, in particular extremist political influence. You see this very much in American criminal justice today, in which tough-on-crime platforms pushed by politicians make their way into the practice of criminal justice in a way that doesn't happen in other countries. The Nazis, far from rejecting our American forms of political democracy and the American common law admired those things. That really seems to me to deserve a lot of emphasis, because we tend to think, as we see horrific events like the events in Charlottesville, that the greatest danger we face is the danger of the loss of our democratic institutions, of what we think of as traditional common law liberty. That's a mistake. Those institutions are in some ways wonderful and have had produced magnificent results sometimes, but they also lend themselves to some of the nightmarish practices that the Nazis admired. So Nazism, or let me put it in the American terms, white supremacy is not only not alien to our society, it's in a fundamental way not alien to the way our institutions work, and that means we've got to take a really hard look at the way we do things in the U.S.
And the book helps us do that so much. It's one of the most engrossing and disturbing pieces of legal history I've read in a long time.
Urge
all of our listeners to do so. Hitler's American Model, the United States and the Making of Nazi Race Law. Professor James Whitman, thanks for spending some time with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Don't stand back and look on.
Sisters and brother New Yorkers did give their hands to struggle. For the last 3 days, they have been out in force at Trump Towers. So let's hear from some of our fellow New Yorkers who I recorded declaring to Trump, "You have blood on your hands," in protest at Trump Towers.
You're carrying a drive-out Trump.
The Trump-Pence regime refused fascism.
The irony for some of us of being next to Cartier, Neiman Marcus, Bergdorf Goodman, Tiffany, and there's Trump Tower. What does all this mean?
If the people of Germany had recognized what was coming decades ago, they would have taken to the streets. They didn't say anything when they came for people who were different than them. What's happening in this country is exactly what happened with the rise of fascism and the Nazis. It's really, really terrifying. I'm embarrassed that the white supremacist calls my city his home. We hate him here. We want him out. He is a danger to this country. He is a danger to the world. He is a danger to the planet. He is a danger to civilization in its entirety.
And what borough or what city did you come from today?
I live in Washington Heights in Manhattan, and I am thrilled to see that our numbers are growing and growing. What happened in Charlottesville over the last couple of days is bringing the alt-right out of the closet, and people are recognizing that they are nothing more than white supremacist thugs, many of them rich business people. We must declare that the alt-right is nothing more than unsheeted KKK white supremacists.
and the United States of America, the good people of our democracy, will have none of it.
And you are?
My name is Laura Moore.
Thank you, Laura.
Rise up, people of the world, rise up. Rise up, people of the world, rise up.
Rise up. Donald Trump has got to go.
Hey, how's it going?
You blew the sound bite.
I'm sorry.
Well, okay, you have another chance. Well, let me ask you. After what happened in Charlottesville, what is your message today?
Ultimately, what happened was a white supremacist attack. We need to weed out white supremacism in all our institutions and all the stratas of the U.S. economy and system.
And you see the connectedness between the anti-immigrant activity, rhetoric, and policy, and the anti-Muslim policy and rhetoric, and what happened in Charlottesville?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, racist speeches and racist attacks and whatnot sort of lean into all together. For example, the majority of Muslims in the USA are black. So anti-Muslim speech is generally anti-black speech. So it's not necessarily coded or any of that. It's pure, blatant, racist, anti-blackness, anti-immigrant, anti-people of color. It's just white supremacist speech. I mean, he has Gorka, he has Bannon. People around him are generally white supremacists. So it's not like it's not something special. It's not something new. He's not hiding the fact that he's a white supremacist and that the people around him are, and that he fully condones them.
And do you mind telling me what borough you're from and who you are?
I'm from Hell's Kitchen. My name's Omar Guayan. I'm a PhD student over at NYU.
Thanks for speaking with WBAI Radio.
Thank you very much.
No hatred in the USA. We protect anyone who stands against them.
Yeah.
And so we remember Heather Heyer today, and we thank her for her righteous work. And she is a hero. And to the Trump and Pence regime and its supporters, we say no. There's blood on your hands, and we vow to organize to stop this.
And our hero is that you were referencing?
Heather Heyer.
Tell us about her.
Heather Heyer was murdered yesterday by a white supremacist who intentionally drove a car into a crowd of protesters who were righteously counter-protesting a KKK rally.
And let me understand, does your family, do your friends similar to you take such umbrage and feel as furious as well you should, but at this white supremacist, neo-Nazi, hate-mongering effort that is clearly licensed by the President of the United States?
Well, my friends and family are all the people who came out here today in this city and in cities around the country to stand up against this, and I'm very proud to be part of this.
And what area of the city are you from?
I'm from Brooklyn.
Great. Do you mind telling us who you are?
Sure, my name is... Well, is this for an interview, a media?
Yes, it's WBAI Radio.
Oh, I love WBAI. Okay, this is Eva Sahana.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We refuse to accept
a fascist America.
A fascist America.
In the name of humanity.
In the name of humanity.
No.
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 Drive out.
Drive out.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
These three authors may have all come from fundamentalist backgrounds, but their stories are all different.
We will almost certainly see attempts from this administration to push us back into our closets. But I know we will fight tooth and nail to keep everything that we have won through decades of relentless activism.
Well, if gay liberation means freedom for all, a label is no liberation at all.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. There's no high court road to marriage equality in Northern Ireland. Three queer authors re-examined their religion and tracing the troubling Trump trail back to Orlando's Pulse. All that and more this week because you tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 19, 2017. Northern Ireland's top court has ruled out a judicial road to marriage equality. Justice John O'Hara rejected two cases on August 17th at the High Court in Belfast that had challenged Northern Ireland's heterosexuals-only marriage laws, deciding that only lawmakers in the National Assembly can change them. In one case, a Northern Ireland gay couple that had legally married in London sought recognition of their marriage at home. And in the second, a lesbian couple and a gay male couple, who were each among the first to enter into less-than-equal civil partnerships when Northern Ireland created them in 2005, were asking the High Court to recognize their unions as marriages. Northern Ireland is the only major part of the United Kingdom to deny marriage equality to same-gender couples. London's Independent newspaper counted five different attempts in Northern Ireland's National Assembly to open civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples. The entrenched ruling Democratic Unionist Party has blocked all of them, and there's no sign that the government intends to change its resolute opposition.
Criticism continues in Australia over plans by the administration of Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull to hold a voluntary, non-binding postal plebiscite on marriage equality. The Liberal Party National Party coalition government has delayed a bill to define the processes for the postal survey until Australia's High Court issues a ruling on a case they'll hear on September 5th challenging the validity of the $122 million survey. If the postal plebiscite goes forward, according to Media Access Australia, blind or vision-impaired people won't be able to vote without outside help because a braille version of the ballot or an online voting option won't be available. An estimated 275,000 blind or vision-impaired Australians of voting age could be disenfranchised.
Meanwhile, one rebel senator is circulating amendments to government legislation that include changes in the Marriage Act to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. Senator Skye Kokoshi-Moore is also pushing for a free vote on the issue. I urge all parties to use this opportunity for parliamentarians to do the job we were elected to do, she said.
The Australian Bureau of Statistics, rather than the Electoral Commission, has been tasked with conducting the postal plebiscite. They're supposed to announce the results on November 15th, a week after mail-in balloting closes. But the Sydney Morning Herald reported this week that rank-and-file members of the Public Servants Union at the Statistics Bureau have grave doubts about the vote being done properly in the time frame ordered by the Turnbull government. Some called it a rush job that will not deliver an accurate picture of Australian opinion on the issue. The Community and Public Sector Union surveyed its members and found almost 3 in 4 respondents didn't think the Bureau was the proper agency to oversee the postal plebiscite. While the Bureau's boss conceded to his staff that getting the job done by November 15th will be challenging, one of his deputies dismissed the union members' concerns as representing only about 5% of the Bureau's workforce.
Elsewhere, landmark legislation to protect transgender people was introduced in the lower house of Pakistan's legislature this week. The Transgender Persons Protection of Rights Bill and the Transgender Persons Protection of Rights Criminal Law Amendment Bill would provide non-discrimination protections for the trans community and criminalize acts of violence and discrimination. Pakistan's constitution outlaws discrimination based on sex. Proponents of the legislation say that one of their goals is to expand that definition to include gender identity and expression. Physical violence against transgender people has been on the rise in Pakistan. One report documented at least 49 murders and 390 cases of physical violence against transgender people in the past 18 months. The recent widely reported brutal murder of a 17-year-old trans teenager who took the name of Mendy when she completed her transition at the age of 14 seems to have moved many to support the legislation. Sabahat Rizvi, an advocate for trans rights who's worked closely on developing the legislation, told the Washington Blade that the teen's murder has shaken all of the policymakers and mobilized the media. Pakistan's Supreme Court ruled in 2009 that transgender individuals have the right to designate themselves as third gender on official ID cards, but the government has since failed to advance that progressive decision.
Meanwhile, Joe Strauss, the Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives, foiled Governor Greg Abbott's renewed effort to pass a discriminatory bathroom bill that would have forced trans people to use sex-segregated public facilities that match their biological sex. Abbott's Republican-dominated Senate passed the bill during its regular session, but House Speaker Strauss, a more moderate Republican, expressed his strong opposition and wouldn't allow a vote in his chamber. The governor then called a special session at taxpayer expense to push through parts of his legislative agenda that didn't get approved during the regular session, and he identified the bathroom bill as his top priority. But history repeated itself this week when Strauss again blocked a vote in the House. The special session adjourned soon after the bathroom bill circled the drain. Tens of thousands of Texans spoke out against the bill during the regular and special legislative sessions, including CEOs of 27 Fortune 500 companies, nearly 500 faith leaders, and more than 50,000 people who signed petitions or testified against the measure. Abbott could push for the bill's passage again in the next legislative session.
In other news, at least three people were hospitalized in St. Petersburg with chemical burns this week after a group of nationalist skinheads used pepper spray against a group of about 100 LGBTQ people and their allies celebrating Pride in the Russian city's Field of Mars Park, which is designated as a free speech area. A dozen other Pride participants, including at least one journalist, were hurt in the melee. One of the organizers of the gathering said they were worried about such violence, but police denied their requests for protection. According to one Russian-language media report, the assaults came as the event was coming to a close, with participants lying on the grass, launching rainbow snakes into the sky, and singing songs. St. Petersburg authorities announced a few days later that they were opening a criminal investigation into the Pride assaults, but it's not known if anything will really come of that. Several of the attackers can be identified with video footage that's already been widely circulated. Organizers hailed the bravery of the Pride participants and said the city's eighth celebration of all things queer was the largest since 2010. At least one Pride participant was arrested. Lesbian activist Anna Grabatskaya was handcuffed by police for holding up a sign that read, "I love my wife." They considered that to be a violation of the country's ban on gay propaganda, for which Grabatskaya faces up to 10 days in jail.
A celebration of LGBTQ pride in Uganda has been shut down again. Organizers reluctantly canceled this week's events in and around Kampala in a statement via the Kuchu Times on August 16th, saying that going forward could have put innocent people's lives at risk. Uganda's Ethics and Integrity Minister, Simon Lokoto, directly threatened to use the police to attack and arrest anyone who dared to wave a rainbow flag. As he demonstrated last year, that was no idle threat. Police raided a kickoff pride parade and blocked the planned 2016 march from happening. This morning, we woke up to a tirade of police surrounding the venue of the opening gala, the organizer's statement read. And later in the day, even as talks with police and other relevant authorities were ongoing, more deployment was made to the venues of the events that were to follow. Organizers vowed to continue the fight for equality. One day soon, their statement promised, "We will reap the fruits of our dedication and persistence."
And finally, advocates in Reykjavik may be pushing for the addition of one more letter to the all-inclusive alphabet soup that defines sexual and gender minority communities. They are asexuals who experience little or no sexual attraction to people of either gender. A group called Asexual Iceland marched for the first time in the city's queer pride parade on August 11th. One of the organizers said they hope to dispel many misconceptions about asexuality, an idea that's still relatively foreign to most people. Asexual Iceland might also like to see an A added to LGBTQI.
Now try it with the other I, Francis.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 19th, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org. You can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
In addition to the horrifying Pulse shooting, there have been a lot of upsetting changes in the past year. For me, the largest and most worrying change that occurred in the past year was our change in administration.
We'll take the pulse of queer youth under Trump later in the program. Reviewing three books on religion, This Way Out Queer Life and Literature commentator Janet Mason sits down to drink from the silver cup, put on a straight face, and introduce us to a faithful son.
Just when I was starting to think that, well, maybe religion gets a bad rap, I was jolted back into reality by reading three recent books on the theme of religion written by queer writers. An article in the Baptist News Global cites Pew Research Center's findings that 62% of people now say homosexuality should be accepted by society. This is 12 points higher than when the same question was asked in 2007, when the acceptance of homosexuality stood at 50%. That religion is changing, and so rapidly, is a good thing. We're all spiritual people, and religion does have something to offer. It can use its power to heal rather than to hurt. The first book I read was To Drink from the Silver Cup, From Faith Through Exile and Beyond, Terra Nova Books by Anna Redsand. As an adult, Redsand explored many of the same alternative spiritual traditions that have fueled me, such as yoga and the Gnostic Gospels. But since she was raised fundamentalist and encountered discrimination early on, she eventually found a Christian congregation that embraced her whole self. Redsand, who was raised by missionary parents in the Navajo Nation, is particularly insightful in her analysis of oppression. Redsand writes movingly about the alternative reality that many, especially those from religious backgrounds, experience. 21, when Stonewall happened in 1969, I was then grieving the end of a guilt-ridden clandestine affair with one of the nurses at the mission's hospital. In Straight Face, Greenbridge Press, author Brandon Wallace writes eloquently about the reality of living a dual existence as a gay person who had entered the ministry of a fundamentalist religion that denounced gays. He shows us how this is extremely unhealthy, but he also explores how he felt called to come out of the closet, become his authentic self, and help others, after he read about a gay teen who had died by suicide. While I was reading, all of my past came screaming back at me. I thought about my own suicide attempts and all the nights I lay in bed and thought about doing the same thing. A Faithful Son is a novel by Michael Scott Garvin that explores the life of a young man growing up gay and fundamentals in a small town in the South. Boys like me grow up crooked, he writes, and tells us the story of how and why the narrator had to leave the small town and move to Los Angeles. The narrator is devoted to his mother and writes movingly about her final days. Ultimately, he writes not about finding faith in the end, but about the narrator finding himself, and maybe in some ways that is the same thing. These three books are a testament to difference. These three authors may have all come from fundamentalist backgrounds, but their stories are all different. What they have in common was that all three authors were raised in a strong faith that gave them something, but to preserve themselves, they had to leave. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Everyone thinks that I'm a freak, the way I dress, the way I speak. I'm too thin, I hate my voice. I'd switch lives if I had the choice. I'll be tall and rich someday. Everything will go my way. Someday, someday.
You don't have to be a freak, or even young, for the last year to seem fraught with challenges. A commentator from the LGBTQ Youth Outcasting radio show shares her thoughts about our post-pulse world.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Max, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Brianna revisits the topic of the massacre at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida on June 12, 2016, and discusses events that have affected the LGBTQ community in the year that has passed.
A little over a year ago, the largest shooting on American soil took place in Orlando, Florida. On June 12, 2016, between the hours of 2 and 5 a.m., 49 people died and 58 were injured during an attack at Pulse, a gay nightclub. The LGBTQ community was in shock, and the media ran the story for days, focusing on possible connections between the shooter and terrorist organizations. I wrote a piece last year that shared my feelings surrounding what happened at Pulse and how the mainstream media portrayed it. It's been a turbulent 14 months, so I think it's beneficial to look at what's changed in our community, what might change in the future, and how those changes affect us. Not much has changed in how mainstream media treats the attack on Pulse, except that there isn't much of it anymore. The only memorials for Pulse victims I have seen have come from the LGBTQ community. There is nothing I have seen in mainstream media that has addressed the anniversary of that night. The media coverage on this attack was short and filled with talk of ISIS-fueled terrorism, with only a few placing emphasis on the LGBTQ aspect of the shooting. These circumstances remind me of the upstairs lounge fire, which, until the Pulse massacre, had been the most deadly anti-LGBTQ attack in American history. The fire at the upstairs lounge, located in New Orleans, Louisiana, killed 32 people in 1973 and received national news coverage for only 3 days. And once the media found out that it had been a gay bar, the coverage took on a horrendously derogatory tone. While coverage of the Pulse massacre hasn't been as directly homophobic as the coverage for the upstairs lounge, mainstream media has largely omitted that it was a gay nightclub and that homophobia was almost certainly the shooter's motivation. In addition to the horrifying Pulse shooting, there have been a lot of upsetting changes in the past year. For me, the largest and most worrying change that occurred in the past year was our change in administration. I refer, of course, to the 2016 presidential election. It was hands down the most divisive, confusing, and stressful election we've had, at least in my memory. From rumors of Russian interference to a now victorious candidate with a habit of contradicting not only everything he's ever said, but everything his aides and surrogates have said, the election alone was exhausting. For the longest time, it was impossible to tell exactly what President Trump's position on LGBTQ issues was, but his opinions were made clear in a series of tweets on July 26th. Claiming to have consulted with military leaders, President Trump announced that the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. Trump stated that the military cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgenders in the military would entail. On the campaign trail, Trump proudly declared that he would be protecting the rights of LGBTQ citizens, but this seems to be another campaign promise he's forgotten. The decision to ban transgender people from the military doesn't make sense if you use medical costs to justify it, as Trump did. According to the RAND Corporation's research, transition-related medical procedures raise defense health costs by roughly 0.04 to 0.13%. That amount is so small that it's laughable the president is so concerned about it, especially when you consider that the military spends about 10 times as much money on medication for erectile dysfunction, according to PolitiFact. And if Trump were really so concerned about taxpayers' money and how it is used, he wouldn't take any more trips down to Mar-a-Lago, which have already cost taxpayers millions of dollars, according to multiple sources. While he continues his attempts to undo everything put in place during Barack Obama's time as president, President Trump has cemented his stance against the transgender community. In doing so, he has made clear his opinion of the LGBT part of the community as well. In addition to the announcement that transgender service members could soon be fired, the Trump administration has recently been taking an even more anti-LGBTQ tone. The Department of Justice, under the leadership of Attorney General Jeff Sessions, has argued that sexual orientation discrimination is not covered by the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Despite the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's published position, the Department of Justice does not believe that discrimination based on sexual orientation is sex discrimination. President Trump has also recently appointed Sam Brownback to be Ambassador of Religious Freedom, a position responsible for promoting religious freedom as an element of U.S. foreign policy. Sam Brownback has been historically anti-LGBTQ, opposing same-sex marriage and signing state legislation to exclude LGBTQ university students while he was governor of Kansas. He uses religion as a conduit to encourage traditional marriage between a man and woman, a view that seems out of place for someone who is meant to be promoting freedom of religion. Meanwhile, Vice President Mike Pence's views are clear. As governor of Indiana, he pushed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which allowed businesses the right to refuse services to LGBTQ people. In addition, Pence's crusade against Planned Parenthood, his opposition of needle exchange programs, and his documented desire to divert money intended for HIV prevention to organizations providing conversion therapy led to an outbreak of HIV in Scott County. He has also said that gay couples signal societal collapse, opposed a law that would prohibit workplace discrimination against LGBTQ people, rejected a directive that would allow transgender students to use the bathroom of the gender they identify with, opposed the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and more. In February of 2016, Justice Antonin Scalia died, leaving an empty seat on the Supreme Court. Following his death, Senate Republicans vowed to block President Obama's Supreme Court nomination until a new president took office. President Trump's Supreme Court pick, Neil Gorsuch, has already taken an extremely anti-LGBTQ stance. Gorsuch made clear in his 2004 philosophy dissertation for Oxford University that he did not believe the Constitution protected the right for same-sex couples to marry. It's unclear whether or not his opinions have changed over time. Rumors have been flying for months that Justice Kennedy, so often the court's most influential swing vote, will retire in the coming year. If Kennedy retires, President Trump will be able to nominate another judge for the Supreme Court, and could very well nominate a more conservative judge. This could mean decades of conservative domination in the nation's highest court, a nightmare for LGBTQ individuals whose rights could be severely threatened. Right now, things are not looking good for the future of the LGBTQ community under the Trump administration. Looking at the views of these leaders, we can expect attacks on our rights to become more common. We will almost certainly see attempts from this administration to push us back into silence, back into our closets. But I know the LGBTQ community. I know we will not tolerate these attacks. We will fight tooth and nail to keep everything that we have won through decades of relentless activism. The last year has been full of surprises and shocking political developments. It has been full of scandal and controversy. the year ahead of us will likely be the same. We cannot get tired. We cannot stop fighting for each other. If the world seems to forget us the way they have forgotten the victims of Pulse, then we must do what we have always done and continue to defend this community. And we must continue to demand equality for every member of the community.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 50 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to the show. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy this way.
The BBC's live July 30th I Feel Love concert marked a UK legal milestone, the 50th anniversary of the Sexual Offences Act, which partially decriminalized private consensual adult same-gender sex. Trailblazing singer-songwriter Tom Robinson was among the featured entertainers, and he sang an updated version of his classic anthem, Glad to be Gay, a song the same BBC had banned when it came out in 1978. A couple of days before the big show, Robinson paid a visit to Gay Star News and treated them to an exclusive acoustic preview, adding some new lyrics at the end.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Just sing if you're happy that way. 42 years now I've fought for the right for people to love just whoever they like. Today we can laugh as we march to the park, and Clause 28's been consigned to the past. Well, if gay liberation means freedom for all, a label is no liberation at all. Bisexual, lesbian, flexible, straight, we're in, we're human, and all happy to say. Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy this way.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Francis O'Brien and Wenzel Jones, produced by Steve Pride, Janet Mason, and Outcasters Max and Brianna, produced by Mark Sofos. Bronski Beat, David Brown, and Tom Robinson performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KLAI, Laytonville, California, WLRI, Christiana, Pennsylvania, 2NSB, Chatswood, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What role does loyalty play in radical political formations? The answer would be a lot. Group cohesion and the ability to take concerted action are jeopardized when people go this way and that, when participants don't throw themselves behind at least the basic agenda of the party or organization. In many Marxist groupings, loyalty and respect for party leadership have been viewed as paramount. But in the view of Philip Bounds, nonconformity and eccentricity can also matter a lot, and it certainly did in the case of, in the person of, T.A. Jackson. Jackson was a British socialist, a nonconformist, and a stubbornly independent thinker who nevertheless, according to Bounds, was enormously effective in pushing for radical social change. Jackson wrote a memoir published 2 years before his death in 1955, which, according to Bounds, evokes what might be called the outsider's road to socialism. T.A. Jackson also wrote about writers like Charles Dickens and Shakespeare, both about what he saw as their political views and about how those views found expression in their literary works. Philip Bounds, an historian and critic who has published widely on the intellectual history of the British left, wrote an article about T.A. Jackson that appears in the current issue of the journal Socialism and Democracy. When Philip joined me from the UK, I asked what motivated him to research and write the article.
Well, I think T.A. Jackson is an underrepresented figure in communist historiography. Not many people have written about him. Those that have written about him have written about him in very little detail. And he seems to me to be a very important figure in the history of the world communist movement for a number of reasons. Probably the most important reason is that he is one of the most important examples of the kind of self-taught working class intellectuals who flourished in the world communist movement in its heyday. The World Communist Movement back in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s was renowned for encouraging men and women who may not have had much in the way of formal education to master intellectual disciplines like history, philosophy, science, and so on. And in the British context, I think T.A. Jackson is the most distinguished example of that species of self-taught working-class intellectual. Another reason I think he's quite important is that his personality and his outlook, in some respects, set him apart from his fellow communists. The world communist movement in Jackson's day was, in some respects, quite a dour phenomenon. The world communist movement put a premium on things like earnestness, loyalty, respect for leaders, and things like that. And the point about T.A. Jackson was that he wasn't very good at things like earnestness and loyalty and respect for leaders. Although he was loyal to the British Communist Party, nevertheless, he had a very sceptical and mischievous and questioning personality. He wasn't the sort of person who would allow the leadership of the British Communist Party to get away with things that he disagreed with. And he did have this kind of mischievous attitude to politics, which makes him a very attractive figure, I think, in retrospect. And one of the things I argue in my article about him is that this questioning, mischievous, sceptical perspective grew out of the fact that he was something of an outsider. Jackson was one of those people who never really fits in any given milieu. And I think his scepticism, his willingness to criticize the leadership of the Communist Party, his irreverence towards the kind of encrusted rituals of the world communist movement was an expression in part of the fact that he didn't fit in and was incapable of the kind of absolute loyalty and leader worship which at times tended to disfigure the world communist movement in the age of Stalin.
So T.A. Jackson, he was born in London in 1879. Do you have any sense of what might have given him a sense of not belonging or not fitting in early in life?
Yes. I mean, he was born, as you say, in 1879 in Clerkenwell in London. He was born into a working class family, but a skilled working class family. His father was a compositor at a local print works. Some of his relatives were blacksmiths and carpenters and things like that. So there was a respect for skill in the Jackson family. But Jackson wasn't an altogether typical working class child. He was, as you say, an outsider from early on. And there were a couple of things, I think, which accounted for this. The first was a physical reason. Jackson was very short-sighted. He was born astigmatic. His eyesight was very poor. And what that meant was that he wasn't able to participate in the games that his childhood friends played in the streets around his home as fully as he would have wished. And even when he did get a pair of glasses, which enabled him to see better than before, even then he was somewhat set apart from his contemporaries because his parents made it clear to him that they couldn't afford to replace the glasses if they were broken. So Jackson was a slightly solitary figure on those grounds. But another reason, I think, for being set slightly apart from his contemporaries was that he very early on acquired a passion for reading and knowledge and history. His father was a radical trade unionist who was very sympathetic to the movement for Irish independence. And early on, he would read to T.A. Jackson from history books and story books of other kinds. And Jackson acquired a very deep love of narrative and of history at an early age. And to a certain extent, that set him apart from his contemporaries.
What kind of education or schooling did Jackson receive as a child?
He received very limited education, like so many of the people who joined the World Communist Movement in the 20s and 30s and became self-educated. Jackson was educated formally only for a very short period. He was educated at the Duncombe Road School in London between 1886 and 1893. So he was about 13 when he left school. Like most other working class children of the time, he left school and went out into the world of work.
And I want to talk more about T.A. Jackson's life, including his teenage years, in the context of his memoir. He wrote a memoir. It's entitled Solo Trumpet. It was published in 1953. Now, in your essay, you differentiate Jackson's memoir from other autobiographies written by British radicals. So what do those autobiographies tend to portray in terms of their tone and the kind of person portrayed?
As I said earlier, Jackson was an outsider. And I think what distinguished his memoir, Solo Trumpet, from that of many other communist memoirs is that it is preoccupied precisely with the way in which outsiders become committed to the left and the role which outsiders can play in the left. And it's that, I think, more than anything else, which distinguishes Jackson's book from that of many other communist autobiographies. Many communist autobiographies produced by people of Jackson's generation were studies in respectability. That is to say, although their authors portray themselves as implacable opponents of capitalist society, nonetheless, they also emphasize their own respectability. And often what happens is that they portray their conversion to the politics of the left as a byproduct of the fact that their inherent goodness, their inherent moral concerns, their inherent respectability is somehow frustrated by the nature of capitalist society. One of the classic instances of this is the first volume of William Gallagher's memoirs, a book called Revolt on the Clyde, which came out in the 1930s. Gallagher was a Scotsman who was a communist MP in Britain between 1935 and 1950. And what's interesting about the early parts of Gallagher's book is the fact that he gives the impression that his early employers in Scotland didn't live up to his own high moral standards. He writes at length about working for an exploitative grocer in Scotland who pays him very little and overworks him and so on. And the impression one gets is that an almost saintly Gallagher is appalled by the immorality of his early employers and becomes a convert to the politics of the left on those grounds.
That's Philip Bounds. He's an historian, journalist, and critic, and we are talking about an article he contributed to the journal Socialism and Democracy, the article being about the British communist thinker, writer, and agitator T.A. Jackson. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So does Jackson, in his memoir, does he likewise depict himself as a conscientious worker whose idealism is shattered by exploitative employers?
No, not really. This is precisely what Jackson doesn't do, and it's what makes Solo Trumpet such a refreshing piece of work. Jackson left school, as I said, at 13, and he went to work then in a print shop near Chancery Lane in London, and he was apprenticed as a print worker for 7 or 8 years until the age of 21. And the section of Solo Trumpet which deals with that period of Jackson's life makes it clear that he was not at all a committed or ideal employee. On the contrary, the impression Jackson conveys in that section of the book is that he was, in a sense, the employee from hell. He was someone who didn't want to go to work, wanted to spend his time reading, was horrified by the thought that he would have to spend the best years of his life toiling away for many hours a day in a print shop. And so when he writes about his early experiences of work, what he is writing about, in a sense, is his own incapacity to settle down to the natural discipline of the workplace. There are some very entertaining passages in the book where he talks about simply leaving the print shop and walking around London and being enchanted by the streets near the print shop where he worked and their aesthetic associations and their historical associations and so on. There are other passages where he talks about climbing through the window of the print shop onto the roof of the building and taking out a book and spending hours reading it when he should have been engaged in his print work and so on. So the impression he conveys is not of a highly respectable young man whose idealism is stymied by the capitalist system, but of a slightly disreputable, though well-meaning and compassionate young man who acquires a dislike of capitalism precisely because it is making too many demands upon him and precisely because it is preventing him doing the things he loves, reading, walking around, exploring the historic byways of London and so on.
So after he finishes his apprenticeship, I imagine he looks for employment, for kind of permanent employment in the printing business. How did that search go?
Well, it went very badly. He finished his apprenticeship at the age of 21 in about 1900. And when he went to try and find work, he found that he had been blacklisted throughout the trade. No one wanted to employ him because he had a very bad reputation. And he had a very bad reputation, on the one hand, because he had been such an unreliable apprentice, because he hadn't been able to adapt himself to the disciplines of the workplace. But he was also blacklisted because by this time he had become a convert to the politics of the revolutionary left. He'd been something of a militant trade unionist while he had been an apprentice in the print works. And then in 1898, he had read the book Merry England by the great English socialist propagandist Robert Blatchford. And he had been converted to socialism as a result of reading that book. So by the time he finished his apprenticeship, he was known quite widely in London as a kind of socialist troublemaker, a militant trade unionist, a propagandist for socialism. And for that reason, he found that at the age of 21, in effect, his career in printing had come to an end.
Tell me about the political groupings he moved into and apparently out of. And let's start in the first decade of the 20th century. What did he join? What did he participate and get involved in? And what was the end result?
Jackson took a long time to settle down in the revolutionary left in Britain. Although when the Communist Party was founded in 1920, he remained in it until the end of his life. He jumped from group to group in the first 20 years or so of his membership of the revolutionary left. When he was a young man, the leading Marxist organization in Britain was the Social Democratic Federation, the SDF, which had been founded in 1881 by H.M. Hindman, who was probably Britain's first native significant Marxist propagandist. And there was always a certain amount of tension between Hindman and the rank and file of the SDF. And early in the 20th century, Jackson was caught up in a rebellion against H.M. Hindman and the leadership of the SDF. Some people call it the impossibilist revolt, because the young men, and they were primarily young men, who opposed Hindman, felt that Hindman was putting too much emphasis on the need for reforms and insufficient emphasis on the need for the revolutionary overthrow of capitalism. These were young men who believed that the more that a Marxist party emphasized immediate reforms, the less likely it would be to focus people's minds on the need to overthrow the capitalist system and establish a socialist alternative. So these impossibilists, as they were called, launched a rebellion against the leadership of the SDF in the early 20th century. And that led in 1904 to a split in the SDF. And in fact, two new parties were founded at about that time. One was the Socialist Labour Party, the SLP. And that was a party which Jackson was to join much, much later on. But the party which Jackson became a founder member of in 1904 was called the Socialist Party of Great Britain, the SPGB. And the SPGB was committed to the kind of anti-reformist line which I've just mentioned. They believed that any campaigning for reforms in capitalist society represented a betrayal of the socialist cause. So for some time, Jackson was a leading member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, and it was about this time in his life that he began becoming a really good public speaker. He used to speak on Socialist Party of Great Britain platforms, open-air platforms in parks and city squares and so on.
You write that most communist autobiographers portray their entry into the left in rapturously positive terms, seeing it as the gateway to a life of selfless, satisfying, and often heroic activism. Did Jackson portray his conversion to socialism in this way?
No, he didn't. I mean, he made it clear that his conversion to socialism and his entry into the world of the left sects represented an absolute climacteric in his life, an important moment in his life. But the other thing he conveys in Solo Trumpet is a sense of exasperation with the internal culture of those parties and of the of what he obviously regards as the ineptitude of the leadership.
Did he have any ill feelings toward his comrades on the Marxist left as far as what they might not have provided him with, what they didn't do for his intellectual and political development?
To a certain extent, yes. I think one of the problems Jackson had with his comrades in these early socialist parties in the first two decades of the 20th century was a sense that they didn't provide him with the intellectual stimulation he craved. Although we think of Marxist parties as being very bookish, and although we think of Marxist parties as making immense intellectual demands on their members, what Jackson found in the first decade or so of the 20th century was that insufficient intellectual demands were being made on him. He wasn't being challenged to widen his area of knowledge and to deepen his knowledge of the areas he was interested in. So there is a sense in which Jackson was disaffected with the leadership of the Marxist parties for that reason. The other reason I think he was a bit disaffected with some of those Marxist parties was he felt that there was a kind of demand for deference on the part of the leadership and a contempt for the more eccentric members of the movement, which he found very hard to deal with. He's particularly critical, as so many British Marxists were, of H.M. Hindman, the founder and leader of the Social Democratic Federation, because he regarded Hindman as a rather contemptuous, autocratic figure who looked down not simply on members of his own party, but on working people as a whole. And he felt that the socialist cause was being held back by that kind of autocratic, slightly snobbish attitude. And he celebrated those members of the socialist movement like himself who behaved very, very irreverently towards leaders like Hindman. There's quite an amusing anecdote in Solo Trumpet about an SPGB member called Moses Beritz. And Beritz, on one occasion, was denied access to an SDF meeting in Salford where H.M. Hindman was speaking. He was thrown out. He was told that he was a troublemaker and that he wasn't welcome in the hall. So what Beritz did was to climb onto the roof of the hall, produce a flute from his jacket pocket, and blow some sort of severely atonal obligatos down the ventilated shaft. So H.M. Hindman, who was on the platform at the time, found himself completely drowned out by this kind of Schoenberg-like assault that Beritz was launching upon him. And the result was that Beritz was persuaded to climb down from the roof and offered a place in the front row of the meeting. So Jackson had great respect for kind of political pranksters like that, who were able to puncture the pomposity of leaders like Hindman without being ill-natured about it.
Philip Bounds joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Philip is an historian, an author, and a critic. He's worked as a lecturer at a number of universities. His books include Orwell and Marxism and British Communism and the Politics of Literature, 1928 to 1939. He's also co-editor of the volume British Marxism and Cultural Studies. And we are talking about a fair amount of research that Philip has done into the life and work of the British communist thinker, writer, and agitator T.A. Jackson, who was born in 1879 and died in 1955. And as Philip has told you, what interests him in Jackson, among other things, is Jackson's outsider status, his fascination with marginality. And Philip Bounds writes that Jackson's memoir called Solo Trumpet evokes, quote, what might be called the outsider's road to socialism. You mentioned that Jackson became an orator, a paid orator, and he went around England giving talks. What kinds of topics did he address in his public presentations?
His range of topics was extraordinarily wide. I mean, having been drummed out of the printing industry at the age of 21, Jackson had to find some way of making a living. And incredible as it may seem to us, what he did was to become a kind of itinerant orator. In those days in Britain, there was a very rich outdoor culture of political oratory. Political orators would stand on soapboxes in parks and on street corners and in city squares, and they would orate, sometimes at great length, and often to very large audiences. His range of topics was extraordinarily wide. He spoke about politics, about economics, about international affairs, about literature, and a variety of other topics. But one of the topics he was particularly enthusiastic about in those early years of itinerant oratory was religion. Jackson, at this stage in his life, was an absolutely militant atheist. He hated religion and believed that a belief in God or any other supernatural force was an inherently reactionary thing which would prevent working people from changing society and establishing a new socialist order. So he propagandized incessantly against religion. And one of the things he did was to emulate the tactic of the great 19th century British radical Richard Carlyle. Because what Richard Carlyle had done was had been to incite the authorities into prosecuting him. He would go on and on issuing blasphemous, provocative material in the hope that he would be arrested and in the hope that he would therefore bring the law into disrepute. You know, his theory was that the more someone was arrested for giving speeches or writing pamphlets, the more ridiculous the repressive censorship laws that existed in Britain would look. And Jackson repeated that tactic himself. When he became a street corner orator, he gave innumerable speeches about religion. He always took care to denounce religion in the strongest possible terms. And there was a period when he found himself being arrested time and time again. And for him, that was a triumph, because although it was a great inconvenience for him, and although he found himself in court and obliged to pay fines time and time again, he felt that he was making a contribution to bringing Britain's censorship laws into disrepute. And indeed, after a while, the police suddenly stopped attending his meetings and stopped arresting him because they realized that they were making themselves look ridiculous rather than discrediting his socialist oratory.
And this breaking of the law, breaking laws that Jackson and maybe many other radicals viewed as unjust, how important did Jackson see that tactic or strategy in the effort to reach the goal of a more just society and institute a more radical form of politics?
Well, in the early stages of his career on the left, not so much later, but in the first sort of 10 or 20 years of the 20th century, Jackson belonged to a group of people who almost thought that it was a principle that one should break the law as frequently as possible. There was a group of people in the SBGB in particular who specialized in techniques for ripping off restaurant owners and so on. They committed crimes incessantly simply because of economic necessity. They simply wouldn't have been able to eat and clothe themselves unless they resorted to theft and petty larceny and all the rest of it. But they justified their criminal or semi-criminal tendencies on the grounds that if the laws in a capitalist society, crudely speaking, exist in order to prop up the capitalist order, then one of the best ways in which a revolutionary can hone his opposition to capitalism is to break its laws as frequently as possible. So these were kind of cheerful socialist criminals, ripping people off, committing all manner of ingenious frauds in order, in part, to demonstrate their hostility to the society they wish to overthrow.
What did T.A. Jackson, what did he think of factionalism and sectarianism on the left? And what did he do to try to address it?
That's quite a complex question because, on the one hand, Jackson was himself an enthusiastic factionalist. As I've already said, he was an early member of the SDF, soon became exasperated with its leadership, and then became involved in a group of rebels within the SDF who ended up breaking away and joining the SPGB. So throughout his career...
And the SPGB, again, is the Socialist Party of Great Britain. And what is the SPF again?
Yeah, the SDF, the Social Democratic Federation. So as I say, Jackson was himself a factionist at certain points in his career. And throughout his career, he always shied away from the idea that one should simply respect the line that the leadership of a revolutionary party took and that one shouldn't question it. He always retained a deeply questioning and in some cases cynical perspective on his leaders. So on the one hand, Jackson was by no means alien to the world of socialist factionalism. On the other hand, he did feel that he, as a sort of outsider in the movement, had a role to play in reconciling factions because he never felt that he fitted in with any given faction, because he always felt a bit distant from all the different trends in the socialist movement. Jackson believed that he could mediate between the different factions. He could go back and forth between factions in the labor movement and persuade them to cooperate with each other. And Solo Trumpet, his memoir, culminates with the foundation of the Communist Party of Great Britain, the CPGB, in 1920. And one of the things Jackson portrays himself as doing in the closing stages of the text is mediating between the various groups which came together to found the Communist Party, trying to point out areas of commonality between them, trying to build up trust between people in different factions who up until that point hadn't trusted each other at all. So this is a very interesting example, I think, of Jackson's analysis of the role of the outsider in politics. One of the roles is precisely to stand apart from all the existing factions and to mediate between them in such a way as to give rise to a modicum of political unity.
His name is Philip Bounds. He is an historian and a critic, and we are talking about an article he wrote about a really interesting activist and author and thinker named T.A. Jackson, a British communist, and you can find that in the July 2017 issue of the journal Socialism and Democracy. We'll take a short break and speak more with Philip about Mr. Jackson. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Philip Bounds, he holds a Ph.D. in politics from the University of Wales. He's published widely on the intellectual history of the British left. And one man who has intrigued him and now intrigues me is a British communist named T.A. Jackson, who died in 1955. So, Philip, in this article you wrote about T.A. Jackson in the journal Socialism and Democracy, you don't just focus on Jackson's memoir, his autobiography entitled Solo Trumpet. You also look to T.A. Jackson's critical writings on authors like Dickens and Shakespeare. And you write that Jackson's work in this area of literary criticism needs to be seen in the context of an effort to excavate a history, specifically the history of the English radical tradition. Why might that have been important? Why was that important to radicals like T.A. Jackson?
Well, from 1935 on, the interest in excavating the radical traditions of different countries was actually communist policy. It was part of the so-called Popular Front policy that the Communist International adopted in 1935. The Popular Front policy, as is well known, was essentially an anti-fascist policy. Hitler had come to power in Germany in 1933. It was now becoming clear that fascism posed a threat to the European democracies and indeed to the rest of the world. And so the Communist Party adopted the Popular Front policy. Its essence was the belief that in order to defeat fascism, communists had to promote the broadest possible anti-fascist alliance between communists, socialists, but also between liberals and even progressive conservatives. There was this emphasis on the broadest possible anti-fascist alliance to save the world from the menace of Hitlerism and fascism more generally. And the Popular Front policy had a very important cultural dimension to it, which was involved with the excavation of radical traditions, because at the 1935 Congress of the Communist International held in Moscow, the Communist International's president, Georgi Dimitriev, argued that one of the reasons fascists had been successful in various parts of the world was that they had posed as the inheritors of their respective national traditions. So someone like Mussolini in Italy had argued that his movement was carrying forward the distinctive values of the Italian independence movement of the 19th century. In an American context, American fascists were arguing that they were the natural inheritors of the rebel forces in the War of Independence. So fascists had been successful in part by appealing to history and by claiming that they were carrying forward the values of the countries to which they belonged. And Dimitriev's argument was that there has to be a kind of parallel project from the left. If communists are to fight back against fascists, they have to launch their own bid to portray themselves as the culminating points of their respective national traditions. So what Dimitriev urged communists to do was to write about, popularize the history of what you might call plebeian populist movements in their own countries. They wanted to demonstrate to people that in every country of the world there were rich traditions of popular revolt by peasants, by working people and so on, against the elite. But another thing he wanted them to do was to point out that there was a rich literary and artistic tradition which expressed radical sentiments, which sided with the people against the elite, and which in many respects foreshadowed the values of the communist movement. And Dmitriev's appeal had an extraordinary effect in Britain, where for the rest of the 30s, a very large and important body of work was produced on what, as you said, was called the English radical tradition. Actually, of course, communists were interested in the Welsh, Scottish and Irish radical traditions as well. But in those days, England was seen as something which kind of stood in for the rest of the British Isles. So you had books like A.L. Morton's A People's History of England, which told the history of England from the perspective of working class revolt and was an absolutely pioneering work of Marxist history. You had books by Jack Lindsay, which tried to elaborate a total theory of culture. But you also had a lot of books and essays on individual writers like William Langland, John Bunyan, Jonathan Swift, William Blake, Charles Dickens, and so on. And I think it's against that background that Jackson's book on Dickens has to be seen. Jackson published a book in 1937 called Charles Dickens, The Progress of a Radical. And that was one of the three or four most distinguished pieces of work produced in response to Dmitriev's call for an investigation of the history of English radicalism.
And Jackson's book on Charles Dickens, it does at least two things. It looks at what Dickens expressed or conveyed in his novels, and it also looked at who Dickens was as a person, what his political sentiments were, what his political opinions were. Let's start with the way Dickens portrayed people in his novels. How did Jackson think Dickens wrote that reflected well or badly on, for example, capitalism?
Jackson didn't believe that Dickens was a communist, but he did believe that Dickens had a powerful understanding of the problems of capitalism. And in particular, he argued that Dickens's work is dominated by a kind of cultural critique of capitalism. Time and again in Dickens's work, Jackson argues, what we find is the idea that capitalism cripples people emotionally and subjectively, that people live less rich lives than they might because of the cultural imperatives of the capitalist system. And what he meant, I think, was essentially this. Dickens believed, according to Jackson, that capitalism is a system which promotes the idea of self-denial. Because employers have to drive down wages in order to accumulate capital in order to compete on the market, capitalism necessarily emphasizes the idea that we should deny ourselves, that we should lead ascetic, self-denying lives. And Dickens's insight, along with many other cultural critics of the 19th century, was that this emphasis on material self-denial feeds into people's attitude towards their emotional lives. So in other words, having accepted the case for self-denial in economic terms, people then come to suppress their deepest feelings because they feel that that too is something which the existing system demands of them. So Dickens was haunted by this idea that industrial capitalist Britain was reducing people to the level of kind of emotionally impoverished automatons who were becoming increasingly incapable of giving expression to their natural feelings of warmth and humanity and generosity and so on.
And the vulnerable populations in society, according to Dickens, also included children, right?
Absolutely, yes. Having made this general argument about the emotional impoverishment of people in capitalist society, what Dickens does, according to Jackson, is to emphasize that emotional self-denial is particularly hard on children, because for Dickens, children were naturally generous. They came into the world as gregarious, fun-loving creatures. And what was so terrible about capitalist culture for Dickens was that in order to tame children, it had to break their spirit at an early age. And as Jackson points out, one of the most fascinating recurring themes in Dickens's work is the way that the various systems of education which existed in Britain in the 19th century were all directed to this one goal of breaking the spirit of children and making them humble servants of the capitalist order. So if you look, for instance, at the character of Wackford Squeers in Nicholas Nickleby, he relies on physical violence as a means of taming children. He believes that the best way of ensuring that children slough off their natural generosity and compassion is to beat them. Someone like Miss Monsfathers in the Old Curiosity Shop, on the other hand, doesn't use physical violence, but she does imbue children with a sense of their own moral worthlessness. She tells them that they have come into the world as inherently sinful creatures and that their emotions are a byproduct of their sinfulness and therefore need to be suppressed. And somebody like Dr. Blimber, the famous Dr. Blimber in Dombey and Son, isn't so much reliant on violence, but what he does do is try and stifle children by instilling a very repressive system of etiquette. So he tries to bring children up to be young ladies and young gentlemen, and in so doing, he stifles their natural tendency to be playful and life-loving and so on.
Philip Bounds is an historian, an author, a journalist, and a critic. His books include Notes from the End of History and British Communism and the Politics of Literature, 1928 to 1939. We were talking about an essay he contributed to the journal Socialism and Democracy about the British communist thinker and writer and activist and agitator and outsider, T.A. Jackson. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What did Jackson argue was the social and class situation of Dickens himself?
Jackson tended to portray Dickens as a kind of outsider of the sort that he was himself. He portrayed Dickens as a kind of lower middle class radical intellectual who existed on the margins of the British progressive and labour movements. And it's precisely that marginality which conferred on Dickens the ability to analyse the trends of Victorian history so clearly. Here again, we see Jackson's preoccupation with outsiders coming through. What he's arguing is that Dickens was an outsider, and it was precisely his existence on the margin of things which made him such an acute social critic.
Yeah, and we don't have time to go into the details of this, but you write that Jackson represented Dickens as having a career in three stages. During the first stage, Dickens believed that the wealthy would effectively surrender their power and classes would dissolve imminently. So this is kind of an optimistic view that things will work themselves out toward greater equality and justice. And then stage two, Dickens felt that the ruling class, which had become hugely powerful, was not willing to give up power. It was full of pride, and so there was a certain pessimism, a strong pessimism to the second stage of Dickens's understanding. And then after 1848, can you tell us what Dickens believed, according to Jackson, about British institutions and their role in propagating inequality and the capacity, or I should say the willingness, of British institutions to actually address people's concerns?
Yes, there is an overall argument which ties this argument about the stages of Jackson's career together. I think it's important just to clarify what it is. Having argued that capitalist society inflicted emotional poverty on people, Dickens then went on to argue that although working people were subject to kinds of emotional repression, nevertheless, they retained a great deal more warmth and compassion than people from the middle and upper classes. So Jackson's solution to the problem, the cultural poverty of Victorian capitalism, was to argue that working people should be given more power. And he felt that the more power working people got, the likelier it was that their warmth and compassion would irradiate society as a whole and rescue it from the emotional poverty to which it had been reduced. And Jackson's argument is a very startling one. He says that because Dickens was a partisan of the working class movement, his career unfolds in a way which parallels the development of the working class movement. So as you say, in this first stage in his career, he was radiantly optimistic about the prospect of social reform because the Chartist movement in Britain, the movement which campaigned for working people to have the vote, was on the up. Then in the second stage, when Chartism is fading a little bit, he becomes more pessimistic and begins to realize that reform isn't as imminent as he thinks it is. But then in the third stage, which lasts in a sense between 1848 and his death in 1872, Dickens, in Jackson's opinion, becomes extremely pessimistic. Having believed in his early years that the British ruling class would willingly give up its power to working people, Jackson now comes to realize that, in fact, British institutions are specifically designed to exclude working people or prevent working people from exercising power. And this is a theme which he explores in particular with very great pessimism in the novel Bleak House, because as you know, Bleak House is organized around a court case between Jarndyce and Jarndyce, which takes place in London. And Dickens uses the English courts as a kind of metonym, if you like, for English institutions as a whole. And what he argues is that they are deliberately made very complex and very confusing, so that only a small group of initiates can rule them. And the court system in Bleak House becomes a symbol of the absolute determination of the English ruling class to exclude working people from power. And as I said earlier, Jackson didn't believe that Dickens was a communist, but what he did argue was that towards the end of his life, he adopted certain kind of proto-communist positions, and that had he lived longer, he might well have gone over to an out-and-out anti-capitalist communist position, simply because he had come to realize which the British society he had once been quite optimistic about was in fact a thoroughgoing autocracy whose purpose was to ensure the rule of the rich and the exclusion of ordinary people.
That's Philip Bounds. And in fact, he, in his essay in the journal Socialism and Democracy, the July 2017 issue, also brings up George Orwell on Jackson, on Dickens. In other words, Orwell had many things to say about T.A. Jackson's interpretation of Dickens's work and Jackson's understanding of Dickens's political thinking. We don't have time to go into that, but that's a fascinating part of Philip's essay that you may want to investigate for yourself by picking up this journal. Let's move on to Shakespeare, because you also look to Jackson's critical writings on Shakespeare. In this case, it's not a book, as it was with Dickens, but it's an essay that Jackson wrote on Shakespeare. What did Jackson say about Shakespeare's class position and social status?
Yes, Jackson's essay on Shakespeare was called Marx and Shakespeare, and it appeared in the Soviet journal International Literature in 1936. I said earlier that Jackson had conceived of himself as a kind of mediator in the British labour movement. As an outsider, he felt that he could mediate between different factions in the movement. And what he does in the essay on Shakespeare is to portray Shakespeare in similar terms. For him, Shakespeare was something of a social outsider who mediated between different factions of the ruling class, and in so doing was able to illuminate the relationship between them. I mean, Shakespeare was born into a middle-class family. So far as we know, he received a very good grammar school education. But then he decided to move from Stratford to London and to take his chances as a kind of penniless actor and writer in the London theatrical scene. So there was a sense in which Shakespeare made himself an outsider by virtue of his decision to turn his back on his relatively comfortable bourgeois origins and to plunge into the risky world of the London theatre. And Jackson's argument is that, again, Shakespeare acquired a kind of sceptical distance as a consequence of being outside the dominant groups. And this ties in with Jackson's analysis of what was going on in Elizabethan and Jacobean England at the time when Shakespeare was writing. Because Jackson's argument is quite a complex one. He says that what happens in Shakespeare's time is that the emergent bourgeoisie, the middle-class people who were laying the foundations of the capitalist system in Britain, entered into a kind of alliance with the old aristocracy who ran the state, so that there wasn't so much an antagonism between the bourgeoisie and the aristocracy as an alliance of sorts. And what Jackson is arguing is that capitalism is an inherently unstable system. It's characterized by competition and instability and crisis and so on. And what the bourgeoisie was seeking to do in entering into an alliance with the absolutist state, the state of Elizabeth I and so on, was to ensure that capitalism could be stabilized by the actions of a strong state. And Jackson's argument is that Shakespeare had a very acute understanding of that alliance by virtue of the fact that he was positioned, as it were, halfway between the bourgeoisie and the state, and was able to understand the motives of both sides and to see the ways in which their conflicting attitudes could be made to harmonize in an alliance which stabilized capitalism in the early decades of its existence.
How did Jackson see Shakespeare as weighing in on capitalism in his plays?
Shakespeare's evolution is an uneven one, because I think most Shakespeare scholars would now acknowledge that Shakespeare's work changes dramatically after about 1600. The plays he produces in the 1590s, some of the comedies, some of the history plays, tend to be rather optimistic. But then after 1600, suddenly there is this tremendous eruption of pessimism into Shakespeare's work, which expresses itself in tragedies like King Lear and Hamlet and Othello. And what Jackson is arguing, or at least implying, is that this shift from optimism to pessimism in Shakespeare's work reflects the shifting nature of the alliance between the bourgeoisie and the absolutist state. What happens at about 1600, Jackson argues, is that the alliance begins to break down. Whatever stability the bourgeoisie had been able to establish in alliance with the aristocracy now comes to an end, and Britain is plunged back into a period of social crisis, which of course would culminate in the Civil War later in the century. So what Jackson is arguing is that the breakdown of the alliance, which Shakespeare understood so well, led to an enormous amount of social instability, which Shakespeare reflected in the tremendous bleakness and pessimism of his later plays.
Philip Bounds, his books include Orwell and Marxism and British Communism and the Politics of Literature, 1928 to 1939. And again, my guest, an historian and critic and journalist, contributed an article about the British communist thinker, writer, and agitator T.A. Jackson to the July 2017 issue of the journal Socialism and Democracy. Philip, thanks so much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you, C.S.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.